Senate Judiciary Committee. Today we only have one bill on our agenda, which is a rarity for this committee. We normally have 10 to 12 bills on a slow day. Committee, just to give you a heads up, Ann Hoot will be gone the remainder of the week, so we'll concentrate on criminal law and constitutional law this week. Maybe Friday afternoon at 1, we will do some of our civil law work. But we will have a meeting on Friday from probably 1 to 3. Today, I intend to take the public testimony on House Bill 2494, not go into work session today. And then tomorrow and Wednesday, we'll be dealing with Measure 40 and the victim's rights issues. Again, just public testimony, not going into work session. This bill has created a lot of interest, as it should, and the committee has before it both the majority and the minority report, and of course this has the minority report that was adopted by the House as now being the principal bill. In your packet, you'll also have what was in the original bill, and then we have a series of amendments that have been drafted and are before you. The dash 10s are from Representative Bruce Starr, and they would replace the contents of the bill. The dash 11 are from members of the Christian Science space, and they create a new defense for criminal negligent homicide. The dash 12, these amendments come from the original proponents of the bill. Dash 13 was from Representative Lowe, and they would remove the defense with spiritual treatment for certain offenses. And the dash 14 removed the spiritual treatment defense from child abuse. So those are the origins of the dash 10 through 14 amendments. And we'll begin by hearing from opponents, and my goal is to, for the first hour, hear from opponents, and then the second hour to hear from those who oppose the bill, and then following that to take the remaining public testimony. My goal today is to try to complete testimony by 5:30 to 5:45. So if you'll keep that in mind, and as I remind people who testify on controversial bills, in this committee we don't allow applause or jeering, and I know my committee will treat all witnesses with respect, and we expect the same treatment for the senators and the staff that are here. As you hear testimony, if you care not to repeat things that you agree with, that's appreciated. You can just say, I agree with such and such, and in addition, I'd like to add the following information. But with that, why don't we begin then with Representative Lowe, and I understand you would like John Turner and Dr. Larry Lumen to come forward with you at this time. That'd be fine. For those that have testimony, my preference is that it's passed out as you come forward. That way we pay better attention to what's been presented to us. And if you don't have adequate copies, please check with this young man and he'll make sure copies are made. And we always like to leave some also on the back of the table for other people to peruse, and especially if they want to have copies of what you've testified to. Representative Lowe.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Senator Bryant, Chairman, and members of the committee, colleagues. I'm State Representative Kathy Lowe from House District 26, Oregon City and Gladstone, for the record, and I am one of the bringers of this bill to you. It has always been in the state's interest and obligation to protect those who cannot protect themselves. In this case, we're talking about sick and dying children. Protecting children equally under the law is a fundamental premise of this legislation. House Bill 2494 will do this by sending a clear and consistent message to all parents that they are accountable for the physical well-being of their children. Currently, Oregon has an affirmative defense for spiritual healing in various criminal statutes, murder by abuse, manslaughter 1 and 2, criminal mistreatment 1 and 2. There are some others. However, Oregon does not have an affirmative defense of spiritual healing in the negligent homicide statute. This is inconsistent. For example, by allowing the statutory defense to criminal mistreatment, the state is condoning harm to a child if it's done with a sincere religious purpose. But at the same time, by not allowing the statutory defense to negligent homicide, the state recognizes the limitations of spiritual healing and reserves the right to hold the parent liable for harm done. It is this inconsistency and unequal protection of children that House Bill 2494 addresses by appealing the affirmative defenses of faith healing in criminal statutes. The amendments that I submitted would return the bill from its amended form to back to the original form it intended. In addition to its punitive role, criminal law serves as a model. Yes, to the chair, Senator Bryan, to Senator Brown, yes, there.
Thank you.
In addition to its punitive role, criminal law serves as a model and a deterrent for bad acts. It models what conduct and actions society will condone. If the message is confused, deterrence will fail and result in harm and death to children. Sadly, we have seen this borne out in our state and in my county particularly. Children have died, and unless the problem is fixed, children will continue to die. As you review this legislation, colleagues, it is important to note that removing the affirmative defense does not disallow a defendant from raising a First Amendment defense at trial. In no way does House Bill 2494 limit or prevent a defendant from raising a religious-based defense. It simply will cease to be an automatic shield. In addition, there is an argument that this legislation, against this legislation, based upon the premise that parents who treat their children solely by spiritual means are good people. Well, they are good people. They do not intend to kill or harm their child, so they should be, but their argument is that since they're good people, they should be protected from prosecution and harsh penalties. The statutes are structured in such a way that a prosecutor has the discretion to choose the most appropriate charge based upon the facts of a particular crime. We trust prosecutors every day to make these decisions, and there is no reason not to trust the prosecutors in these situations. I agree that parents who practice faith healing do not intend to kill their children, and they are in many ways good people. But just because they do not intend to cause the death of their child does not mean that their actions do not contribute to the death of their child. If my child were to die because I withheld medical treatment, I would be held criminally liable. Why should my child receive any more protection from the law than any other child in the state of Oregon? There are real severe equal protection issues here. I would also like to point out that House Bill 2494 does not outlaw faith healing. Parents still have the right to believe and practice faith healing. But when a child faces serious harm or death, legal protection should apply to every child. I believe House Bill 2494 is a step in the right direction towards protecting all children equally, and I urge your support. I want to thank you for your consideration. I have brought with me several people to testify. I'd like to introduce you to Dr. Larry Luman, the state medical examiner who has studied these cases extensively and been involved extensively, particularly in the cases in Clackamas County. Dr. Luman is seated here to my left. To my right, I have Don Turner. Professor Don Turner, constitutional law professor extraordinaire from Willamette University, and they would like to speak to you about the constitutional implications of this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you.
good afternoon. If you could identify yourself.
Chair Bryant, members of the committee, my name is Larry Lumen. I'm a physician specializing in pathology. I subspecialize in forensic pathology. I wear two hats today. One is that I've worked as a forensic pathologist in the Oregon State Medical Examiner system for 28 years, serving as the chief medical examiner from the state from 1987 till March of this year. By virtue of my position, I also serve as co-chair, along with State Health Officer Dr. Grant Higginson, of the Oregon State Child Fatality Review Team. The 1989 legislature directed the formation of this statewide interdisciplinary team to, quote, review child fatality cases where child abuse is suspected, identify trends, make recommendations, and take actions involving statewide issues. ORS 146 requires Oregon's physician medical examiners to investigate deaths under the statute. These tend to be the violent and unexplained deaths occurring outside of hospitals, homicides, suicides, guns, knives, and all those things. In addition, the law requires the medical investigation of deaths of children from unexplained natural disease, child abuse, or other violence, and from neglect. I want to briefly review from a national perspective the issue of deaths in children and religious groups that reject medical diagnosis and treatment and instead choose prayer as an alternative. I will then review the situation in Oregon. In the early 1970s, the Federal Department of Health, Education, and Welfare issued federal child abuse prevention and treatment grants to the states. They tied with these grants the requirement that the states have in place legal or religious exemptions to child abuse and neglect. Virtually every state adopted these statute at the time in order to get the money. In 1983, the federal government removed this requirement for the religious exemption and left the issue to the states. The states of Hawaii, South Dakota, Massachusetts, Maryland, Nebraska, and probably some others have removed this religious exemption to child abuse and neglect from their statutes. Oregon and many other states still retain, to varying degrees, some form of a religious exemption. The April 1998 issue of the medical journal Pediatrics contained an article that reviewed the deaths of 172 children where the parents withheld medical care, relying instead on religious beliefs. The authors estimated that 90% of these children would have survived with traditional medical care, and only three cases would, of course, likely not have been altered. The deaths occurred from common medical disorders, complications of labor, appendicitis, dehydration, mild infections, and the like. This article surveyed 23 denominations in 34 states. 50 were members of the 50 of the deaths occurred in the Faith Assembly, which is a mid-Atlantic religion. 28 were in Christian Scientists, and these were the two largest groups. This, I submit to you, is only the tip of the iceberg of this problem. It didn't even include the case we're going to talk about in Oregon. The current situation in Oregon parallels that of the natural experience. I'm sure most of you are aware of the media coverage that began in 1998. With KATU-TV in Portland, followed by an extensive Oregonian newspaper investigation, finally culminating in a ABC 2020 national program in January. The precipitating event was the death of three children, the Followers of Christ religious group in Oregon City, during a seven-month period. The Followers of Christ is a religious group of approximately 1,200 members that rejects medical care and believes instead in the power of prayer. I will confine my comments to cases during the last 10 years, since investigation prior to that time was somewhat spotty and inconsistent. Although many preventable deaths of adults have occurred in this group, I'm going to confine my comments to children, since that is the issue before us today. The Followers of Christ Cemetery in Oregon City contains approximately 75 tombstones of children. During the last 10 years, there have been 18 deaths of children in the Followers of Christ group, most or all of these were preventable with medical intervention, and the death rate in this children is estimated by our Clackamas County Deputy Medical Examiner. Basically did some incident studies. You have about 26 times more likely to die as a child in this group than you are in the population at large. For purpose of this discussion, I want to divide these deaths into three categories. These are deaths related to pregnancy, stillbirths, and deaths of living children. Deaths related to pregnancy and stillbirths are probably beyond the power of the legislature to regulate. Unnecessary deaths of living children are a responsibility to prevent. Deaths related to pregnancy. Four mothers, along with three of their unborn children, died of easily treatable infectious complications of pregnancy. One infant survived but was left without his mother, who suffered from a progressive postpartum infection for 2 weeks following the delivery and finally died. The cause of death in each of these cases was referred to as puerperal sepsis. Now, puerperal sepsis is a diagnosis one reads about in the textbooks from the early 1900s, in the pre-antibiotic era. You simply don't see this in this day and age, and most obstetric physicians have practiced an entire career and never lose a patient to puerperal sepsis. And we've had four just in the last 10 years. And no one's going to be charged with these deaths. Nevertheless, these cases represent the senseless suffering and death of four otherwise healthy young mothers and three infants who should have been a thriving part of the family unit. Stillbirths. 10 deaths from stillbirth infants were born or died in the immediate postpartum period since 1990. The Fathers of Christ group rejects professional prenatal and obstetrical care, relying on lay midwives with little or no training. As we all know, cab drivers have delivered healthy babies, but when something goes wrong, an abnormal presentation, a breech birth, something of the like, these midwives are not trained to handle the problem. An emergency cesarean section obviously is not an option in this instance. Two children died of trauma during the birth process. Others died of infection, anoxia, or lack of oxygen to the placenta, and other conditions that are easily treatable. Living children. During the past 10 years, there have been 8 deaths of children between birth and 11 years of age, all of which were preventable with medical intervention and treatment. The aforementioned news media blitz was precipitated by 3 deaths during the 7-month period between June of 97 and February of 98. All of the children were autopsied at the Oregon State Medical Examiner's Office. All were real horror stories involving prolonged and extreme suffering while their adults prayed over their children. In no instance, not one, was medical care summoned. A brief review of these cases follows. In June 1997, a 6-year-old boy had an approximately 30-hour course in illness to death, characterized initially by nausea and vomiting, progressing to extreme abdominal pain, eventually collapse and shock. The cause of death was an autopsy was a congenital hernia that obstructed part of the blood flow to his intestine. His intestine basically died during this process, and this was something that was easily surgically correctable in a hospital. In January of 1998, a 5.5-month-old girl had an approximately 1-week history of a minor illness. She came severely acutely ill at a New Year's Eve party and died several hours later. At autopsy, the cause of her death was a congenital blockage in one of the ureters that carries the blood from the kidney to the bladder. This backup of urine flow caused a secondary infection, overwhelming infection, and the child died. And there was autopsy evidence that this had happened multiple times before. Our medical care was not summoned, and this was surgically correctable. In February of 98, an 11-year-old boy, an approximately 7-day history of a progressive flu-like illness, he became acutely severely ill over about a 12-hour period, eventually became comatose for a long period of time. According to observers, he was resuscitated from death at least twice, once or twice, by followers members and refused to seek medical care. He was treated with prayer, laying on of the hands, and anointed with oil. When our medical examiner arrived, the postmortem temperature was between 104 and 105 degrees, and that was 3 hours after the death. Autopsy revealed the cause of death to be undiagnosed diabetes, with secondary infection and dehydration. As we all know, diabetes is readily treatable by any physician in this day and age. The poster child for this proposed legislation was a 4-year-old boy who died in 1989. His initial illness was a minor respiratory infection. He was treated with prayer as it became progressively worse for the next 46 days, a month and a half, until his death occurred from massive lung and chest infection. This was easily treatable by antibiotics, at least in the early stages. It's time to put a stop to this. We're not talking about Ebola virus or exotic diseases here. We're talking about children dying from well-known medical illnesses easily treated by a physician. The medical examiner investigates all cases of suspected fatal child abuse and unexplained death in the state. These children suffer at least as much, and in many cases more, than the victims of traditional physical child abuse and neglect. Adults have a right to make martyrs of themselves and choose death by this means. The U.S. Supreme Court, as early as 1944, has gone on record as saying that you cannot impose this belief on your minor child. The American Medical Association in 1998, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the National District Attorneys Association, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, National Center for the Prevention of Child Abuse, National Center for Prosecution and Prevention of Child Abuse, and your own colleagues there, the 1989, the Legislative Review Team, to identify trends and make recommendations. All of these agencies have gone on record as advocating to completely repeal the religious exemption statutes in state law. This is a form of child abuse and neglect that needs to be addressed. Remember, please, that I, as the medical examiner, see a very biased population of child abuse. I only see the dead kids. And I really wonder how many living children are allowed to suffer out there from a broken bone that wasn't allowed to heal, a treatable disease such as asthma or diabetes or some chronic childhood infection. These children have no choice in the matter. But Senator Bryant, members of the committee, this is not a religious issue. This is an issue of a child's right to grow up in health. And as we all see too often in the medical examiner's office, many times it's absolutely an issue of a child's right to life itself. So I think we need to move on this legislation. I thank you for your attention, and I would welcome any questions you might have.
Prior to questions, I think we'll hear from the entire panel. Mr. Turner.
Thank you. As previously introduced, I'm Professor Turner from the Lama Law School. Because the bill is proposed to strike several spiritual means exemptions, I suppose it's natural that there would be some concern about the First Amendment provision regarding free exercise of religion. I can be fairly brief. It is not a concern that I think that you need to have. Generally speaking, today in free exercise cases, the Supreme Court has recognized that if you have a statute that is religiously neutral and of general application, the fact that it may incidentally conflict with particular denominations, religious convictions, or an individual member of that denomination's religious convictions, does not require you to provide an exemption for them. The general proposition that a state may impose criminal penalties for conduct that is otherwise criminal, despite a denomination's particular provisions, is over a century old. It goes back to Roberts and the Reynolds, I beg your pardon, and the polygamy case. The case which is probably closest to ours is the 1944 case which Dr. Ullman referred. That will be Prince versus Massachusetts, where the court upheld imposing child labor laws. Even in the situation where the child was under a religious denominational requirement to do this by reference to the biblical injunction that a little child shall lead them, nonetheless, the court held that you could impose criminal penalties upon the parents who permitted the child to do it. Very recently, in 1989, in the case coming out of this state, the U.S. Supreme Court announced that we've never held that an individual's religious beliefs excuse him from compliance with an otherwise valid law prohibiting conduct that the state is free to regulate. That involves ceremonial use of peyote by a denomination that's included as part of their ritual. Even if the Supreme Court should choose to change its view in that respect and return to the more normal view for other First Amendment contexts, which require that there be a public purpose which is clear and the selection of the least restrictive means, I suggest to you that this would probably pass that test as well. Quite clearly, when you're dealing with a child's health, you're dealing with something that has a clear and strong state concern. Based upon the experience we've had with one less restrictive means, and that is the current provision which permits in emergency situations somebody to apply to the juvenile court.
for a court order authorizing emergency medical treatment. If that clearly has not worked, it's very difficult for me to imagine a less restrictive means than those triples.
Well, oh, I should add that also I am confident that this would not violate the state constitutional provisions that you'd find in the second and third sections of the state's Article 1. Oregon has held that you can impose criminal contempt sanctions for child support even as to a member of a denomination whose religious requirements prohibited them from supporting any non-member. Well, turning now to the particular statutes. First of all, repeal of the affirmative defense in murder cases, I think, will work practically no change whatsoever. In order to be convicted of murder, you would have to be involved in elements that I think would be missing. Clearly, these parents do not intend to kill their children. Nor do we have a felony murder situation. The first argument I can think of would that be that this was reckless under circumstances evidencing extreme indifference to the value of human life. That is, I suppose, possible, though I have difficulty feeling that the religious convictions actually evidence an indifference to the value of human life. But turning next to manslaughter. Again, we have currently an affirmative defense to murder by neglect or abuse. It's difficult for me to imagine a situation where that type of murder would be affected by this. The natural caution of a law professor forbids me to say that under no circumstances, nowhere, could somebody come up with a theory. I just can't imagine it. I've got a pretty active imagination. Let me turn to first-degree manslaughter. Again, we have this affirmative defense. First-degree manslaughter includes recklessly under circumstances evidencing extreme indifference to the value of human life. I've already commented on that. But it also includes simply reckless murder, reckless homicide. That would be being unaware of a substantial and unjustifiable risk. Difficult for me to say that these people are unaware of the risk, though clearly they believe that they can avoid the risk by the spiritual means. My inclination is to think that it will work little change in the first degree manslaughter situation. The second degree manslaughter, it will definitely work a change if you remove this affirmative defense. You can commit second degree manslaughter recklessly. I've already mentioned that. But in Oregon, you can also commit second degree manslaughter by criminal negligence. If you are dealing with causing the death of a dependent person or a child under 14. And indeed, it does seem most likely that the parents' religious convictions would interfere with their awareness of the risk. If the trier of fact concludes that this is unjustified under the circumstances, criminal negligence would be appropriate. And if you were dealing with a child 14 or under, that could be second-degree manslaughter. Right now,
As has already been mentioned, we have no similar exclusion for criminally negligent homicide today. This would work no change in that. Now, I turn to first-degree criminal mistreatment and second-degree criminal mistreatment. And I have to say this. Even if you chose not to repeal the exceptions here, I would please ask you to look at the existing exception and consider rewording it. I think it is constitutionally insufficient as worded. I do so because it refers to spiritual treatment through prayer from a duly accredited practitioner of spiritual treatment. We currently have an Oregon case which in another context has declared this to be constitutionally infirm. The fact of the matter is, if you begin to distinguish between denominations or deal with only accredited practitioners, you run the risk that you have a statute which is no longer neutral among denominations. And we cannot, under either the Oregon State Constitution or the Federal Constitution, get into the business of distinguishing between denominations. Indeed, the U.S. Supreme Court has recently had a case involving a city which attempted to outlaw animal sacrifice from a particular denomination during the course of its rituals, while at the same time not applying the same rules to other ritual slaughter. And the U.S. Supreme Court struck it down. Needless to say, if you were going to consider removing the exemption for some, I commend to you the benefits in doing it across the board. It not only promotes uniformity and clarity, but avoids the possibility that you will have citizens who come in and say that they were misled because the exemption existed as to one crime and not as to the other. And if you have any questions, I'll serve you for one.
Questions? Yes, Senator Nelson.
Federal rule, in other words, these exemptions first applied. What was the basis for having those federal requirements?
The basis, as alluded to by Dr. Luman, was a federal statute which was enacted in order to protect this sort of conduct. Please don't misunderstand me. The fact that I say you can do away with them doesn't mean that you could not provide such an exemption. The federal statutes no longer exist, but that's not because it was found to be unconstitutional to provide the exception.
They were repealed in 1984, I believe.
What was the basis for having them in the first place?
I'm sure that the concern was to provide protection for people who wanted to treat by spiritual means.
Thank you.
Sort of encourage providers.
Professor Turner, if a parent knows of a medical condition which, if it goes untreated, could cause death of the child and has access to that treatment and chooses, because of religious reasons, not to avail themselves of it, the child dies, what degree of murder, or is it a degree of murder? I'll let you decide. What crime have they committed?
Well, clearly today they may have committed negligent homicide. If indeed you remove the affirmative defense for manslaughter, they will have committed manslaughter in the second degree. I think it's very doubtful that they've committed murder in any form. and I rather doubt that they've committed first-degree manslaughter.
Well, all right, let me direct you, sir. Let's take the affirmative defense out of it. Let's take that out of it.
All right.
I remember when we, I think it was 89 session, maybe 91, because I remember doing it. I even remember the state representative's law to create the statute of murder by abuse. And later on, I don't know whether, and I wish I would account for neglect and torture. Those sections were all a result of that, but I remember murder by abuse. I think they were all together. And I believe the affirmative defense was created then or not, or did it exist in law? Do you recall? Because they're talking about lines 19 through 22 of the bill before us, where it talks about 1CB. Do you recall?
Let me go to the
site
there. And here, this will list from your...
Right. Right.
I can't tell you.
All right. And let's just do this. I am trying to direct you to murder by abuse, or murder by neglect, or torture of ourselves. But there was that error.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what we're talking about here, in your opinion?
No.
That is not what we're talking about.
I don't think so. The problem is that in addition to that, in order to convict, you must find the person acted recklessly under their circumstances evidencing extreme indifference to the value of human life. That's a peculiar language because law professors disagree as to whether it relates to a mental state or to a set of factual circumstances. But under either approach, I have great difficulty characterizing these parents as being indifferent to the value of human life.
Okay, well.
And I think that belief will be one of the circumstances so that if you look at it, some professors do.
Right, one last question, Mr. Chair, because I'm...
Sorry.
You used the word neutral.
Yes.
Being very definitive.
Neutral and of general application.
So what language in the law is so neutral in general application that you feel it would survive constitutional challenge?
Well, if you remove these, you simply then have laws that apply generally to all our citizens and that are completely neutral religiously. It does not distinguish from one denomination to another.
You mean if you remove the affirmative defense?
That's correct. You were left with a law of general application that is neutral among religions.
But the minority report language in front of us, I'm not trying to argue the defense attorney. I'm not trying to play who's the smarter lawyer here at all. It does allow the affirmative defense. It does allow the affirmative defense to stand under certain circumstances. Isn't that correct? Are you familiar, are you familiar with the bill?
I have glanced, yes.
Okay, I'm not trying to trick you. I'm just trying to...
It
does allow it to exist under certain circumstances. And spiritual means a part of it. That is, they get into the word spiritual in terms of, you've got to be over 18 or something. I'm just inherently reading it here. Does that then mitigate against exactly what you just said about neutrality and general application?
No.
Because
no, I don't think so. To say that you may remove the exemption and have constitutional muster does not say that there's a constitutional prohibition against allowing an exemption to remain.
That's interesting.
Senator Brown.
A couple questions now that I figured out which bill we're working off of. I guess, Representative Walton, I think you talked about a couple things. One is that policy reasons for the 14 years of limiting, having the line be drawn at 14 years old, and then secondly, to walk through your the two issues addressed in your minority report, or not in your minority report, the proposed amendment to the minority report, which addressed each of those.
Yeah. The bill is, as I originally drafted it, and then it got rolled into Representative Starr's bill. That bill drew the line at 18, in the age of 18. And my theory was, in doing it that way, that a child living in a household run by a set of parents that had this one spiritual belief would not be likely to be able to buck the system and get themselves medical treatment. I believe when Representative Prozanski wrote the minority report and then coincidentally Representative Maddox supported it on the floor, when he wrote it, he put in the age of under the age of 15, because there are so many other places in our statutes where a child of the age of 15 has the authority to make medical decisions for themselves. And to be consistent with those, and since the existing manslaughter statute has the age of 14 in there, has the age of 14 listed in there, he wrote his minority report to have the offense, the spiritual defense, be removed as to children under the age of 15. And left it in there as a child of the age of 15 consents to this treatment, then the defense applies. And I took my cue from him in all other respects. My Dash 13 amendments are the same as the original bill, but I did bring it down to 14 in that one spot that you made, Senator Brown. The other thing you asked was the line drawn on those two issues. I guess I addressed that. Okay. Did that answer your question?
So you felt like the issue of the criminal non-support or the child abuse reporting in the minority report?
In the original bill we talked about criminal non-support, that removing the defense as to criminal non-support and child abuse reporting. Those present in Oregon law, there is a reflexive defense, believe it or not, to not providing medical treatment for your child if it's against your religion to do so in a criminal non-support setting. Also, teachers, other people who are required to report abuse do not have to do so in a spiritual, if a spiritual defense would lie. So those children are really vulnerable out there. They're not protected at all. And in my Dash 13 amendments, I go back to the original intent of my bill and stick them back in. It gets the minority report and puts back in the original bill, except for the age of 14.
Thank you.
Hey, Duncan.
I'd like to turn a particular question going to the constitutional issue here. Let's assume the legislature decided to take out the spiritual defense of the child and the criminal defense in the process, but instead chose to allow the judge to use that for consideration in the sentencing thing. What would be your opinion as to the constitutionality of that?
Off the top of my head. I think my reaction would be that it probably would be permissible. In part, that's because the very belief that is the basis for the affirmative defense, it seems to me, could properly be considered by a judge in deciding whether or not it is likely that it is needed to deter others. It is likely that the person will repeat it again, as well as deciding how much sanction is needed for a particular individual. Conceivably, these people act on religious motives.
If I could stop you for a second, Representative Starr is here, who has to get back to his Rules Committee.
So, Representative Starr, if you'd come forward to testify, and if the three witnesses could just step aside for a moment, I'd appreciate it.
If I may be excused to go back to the floor, I have things that I would like to mention to the committee that I have also brought with me, Dale Pym from Marion County DA's office, Susan King from the Oregon Nurses Association, Detective Jeff Green, who was on the site and on the scene, and he's the one that developed the case for Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, Lisa Millett, Grant Higginson, the congressman from SCF, and Bruce Field and Lindy Borg from the Oregon Professional Society on Abused Children. I want to thank you very much for hearing my testimony today and entertaining us. So we have some good work to do ahead of us, and I appreciate the opportunity to present this to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this bill. For the record, I'm Bruce Starr, State Representative from House District 3, Western Washington County. I introduced this bill after, well, let me back up. Last summer, we had a situation in Oregon City. It was in the news, quite a lot of press. At that point, I was running for the legislature. Obviously, my father is a sitting state representative. I had a conversation with my dad. I said, Dad, how can this happen in our state where we can have a child die at that point that several children had died within a reasonably short period of time, and there doesn't seem to be any consequences for it? And it wasn't an issue that my father had any real experience in. Wasn't real sure what the current status of the law was. About that time, I'd had a constituent that had contacted me and explained to me these religious shields that were in the law. And so at that point, I kind of made a decision that this was something that I would like to address if I were to be elected this legislative session, and that's why I brought forward House Bill 2494. And I believe that the state does have a compelling interest in protecting children's lives. This is an issue that's a delicate balance between the parents' religious beliefs, their authority to guide their children's lives, and the right of government to prudently intervene on behalf of the child. There was concern as this bill was heard in the House Committee on Criminal Law. In fact, I believe that originally I had the votes on that committee to move the bill to the floor in pretty close to its original form. However, as the deliberations continued in that committee, there was concern that was brought forward that these parents, if they were charged and prosecuted with the higher crimes, the manslaughter 2, man 1, and murder, the parents, the so-called criminals in these cases, would be subjected to the Measure 11 mandatory minimum. Needless to say, that raised some significant concern with the majority members of the House Committee on Criminal Law. So that set in progress a series of events where the chair of that committee attempted to draft language to address his members' concerns and in a situation and bring forward a bill that would accomplish what I believe the goals here are. And believe me, folks, I believe the goals here are protecting the lives of children and not necessarily attacking religious beliefs. In that process, the chair of the House Committee went through several drafts. What ultimately came out of that committee, I believe, was flawed. And unfortunately, or however, as it went, there was a minority report, and the minority report was adopted and passed. And I really supported the bill coming to this chamber on this side of the Capitol building so that we could continue to work on the bill. I don't have full support of the minority report. I think there's some problems with the minority report, and hopefully the bill as it was passed, and hopefully this committee will amend it, and I believe come to a conclusion that accomplishes the goals that are necessary, and yet does balance those careful interests of parents' rights and the lives of children. I believe that there's little chance or no chance that parents who pray and their child dies will be charged with murder or manslaughter. That's why I removed the, I agreed to remove the fields in my original draft. I said, you know, these parents aren't murderers. You know, there's no need for the fields to be there. They're not going to be charged with that. Obviously, there was concern on the committee that that wasn't the case and that these parents could be subjected to mandatory minimums under Measure 11. And so what I've done is I've had what I believe is the solution drafted to this dilemma, and it's before you in the form of the A-10 amendment, staff A-10 amendment. Since I believe that the higher crimes aren't a place where district attorneys, prosecuting attorneys are going to look to, I agreed that we can leave the field dimmed at that point, looking at the flip side of that argument.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, in front of.
I don't have the A-10, I didn't put the flip side.
They weren't in our packet.
I believe, at least I instructed my staff to provide them to your committee staff. So
we'll get them right now.
I have a copy, so
we'll make some copies.
I can briefly explain what the dash 10s do. What I did in the dash 10s is I took the flip side of the argument. If you don't need the shields and the higher crimes, let's just leave them in as a way to move a bill with broad support. What I did for the lesser crimes of manslaughter 2, criminal mistreatment, and criminal non-support is I introduced a sort of bypass where we leave the shields in the law. But in order for a parent to gain the protection of those shields, that parent must notify the county health department in the event that they have a child that is seriously ill or injured. That way, the county health is notified, and we have an opportunity to intervene in that child's case. However, if a family, if a parent doesn't notify, the shields no longer apply, and that parent is open for prosecution under those crimes. I also, in the adoption amendments, removed the shields as they were originally in the original bill, removed them out of the ORS 419, the child abuse reporting statute. I believe that it's important that we remove those from those statutes so that we can, instead of dealing with this after a child dies, we get it, if, you know, we can handle it ahead of time, do a little prevention here. I believe that this carefully balances the state's interest in protecting the lives of children and the parents' right to practice their religion. And at this point, I'd be happy and willing to answer any questions that you might have.
I think the bills are before us today in part because one district attorney in the state refused to prosecute for criminal negligent homicide, and that happened to be the DA in Clackamas County. And in the particular case, I don't know if it was a good or a bad decision on her part, but other district attorneys I talked to felt that she could have prosecuted if she chose to, at least for the criminal negligent homicide. And what our state apparently decided to do in the past, and Peter, you might have been there when this was determined, but they allow for the defense, the affirmative defense of spiritual treatment in the case of murder by abuse or the manslaughters, but clearly elected not to do that for criminal negligent homicide, which to me, reading between the lines, is the statement was that they didn't want a parent charged necessarily with murder or manslaughter for using spiritual treatment, but would allow that if for criminal negligent homicide, if they believed it was in fact reckless without regard to what a prudent person would deem to be reasonable treatment. And but I'm not sure when that was adopted, but that's what I'm reading between the lines of what why.
That was my question to counsel, because I remember this discussion when we developed murder by abuse in terms of movement, spiritual means, and things like that. And I think that your reading was correct. I'm sure it's I was trying to get a history of the criminal defense murder counsel.
Sure, I have a copy of the Hayes case.
Sure.
If the committee would like to see it, you can put the appellate court on the Joliet version of the negligence for homicide defense. We have a copy also of the opinion letter by Harvey Myers stating that his opinion described the change of 1860 constitutional.
But Ms. Taylor, just the question on what legislature was it that determined that the spiritual defense would apply for murder and manslaughter, but not for criminal negligent homicide, and then therefore made a policy decision that they would allow that type of affirmative defense except for criminal negligent homicide. It had to be a very conscious choice and decision.
I have to go back and check, but I guess the Supreme Court was right. I do remember the discussion of the murder by abuse statute in the same court as the hearing now.
Be in the 80s, I think. I know we have not done it since 93. Because I would have remembered. I'd have been 90. Well, I think it'd be interesting to take a look at some of that legislative history just to see what the rationale and thought was when that was done. Other questions for Representative Starr?
Mr. Chair, if I just might, in closing, one statement. I would urge that you look for a way to come out, if you want to amend these statutes, that you look for a way that we can garner broad bipartisan support. And that's the main reason that I'm bringing the 8-10 amendments forward, is I wasn't really happy with how that bill came out of the House. And I believe that in my conversations with those that opposed the bill if it came through the House, that they would support the 8-10 amendments, even with a little bit of sand in their craw because of the potential opportunity for prosecution under manslaughter 2. I appreciate your listening today, and I urge you all to adopt the 8-10 and all the wisdom of Solomon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll need a little of that. Yep.
I just want to say one thing, Mr. Starr. One of the things we have to be careful about is maybe we could adopt a bill that has broad-based support, only to have it thrown out by a higher court. I do think that's an issue before this committee is reviewed. We can do that, but I'm sure you wouldn't want that effect either. So that's why I'm not sure we can have both worlds and tell you something, frankly. It's something that has broad-based support, also is constitutional. I could be wrong with Senator Starr. It's a very difficult issue, but I think that. I just wanted to add that. I hope you understand that this committee is not just going around, but I think that we have to consider the constitutional implications as well as the broad-based support.
Thank you, Mike. Very good.
Other questions? Thank you. We'll now go then to the testimony of Dale Penn, Susan King, and Jeff Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I'm Marion County District Attorney. I'm representing the District Attorney Association in this matter. I'll try to be very quick because I know you have a lot of witnesses. I will say the District Attorney Association supports the bill that you have in front of you, also the A13 amendments that Representative Lowe has presented to you. Let me give you real quickly some history, which I think is how we've gotten to this point. Murder by abuse was dealt with a number of years ago, and the spiritual defense was assigned to murder by abuse, but it was not assigned to the manslaughter. There was no legal issue because of that change and the development of that new crime, murder by abuse. The problem that came forward was last session, there was an amendment to the manslaughters. And at that time, and that certainly I participated a little bit in that, but I wasn't even aware of the spiritual defense implication in the amendment to both manslaughters. That went into effect last session. And that created a legal issue, which the Clackamas County District Attorney identified, that said, when you look at manslaughter 2, there is the use of criminal negligence in manslaughter 2 when it is by abuse. So you have a situation that the district attorney said, in analyzing this, when there is criminal negligence for criminal negligent homicide, where there is no defense, and criminal negligence resulting in the death in manslaughter 2, child under 14, same conduct. If I choose to charge it under criminal homicide, the person has no defense. If I choose to charge it for the same conduct under manslaughter 2, they have a defense. That creates the legal issue. That was the debate that went forward. Now, there are differing views on what is the proper analysis. No appellate court has ruled on that. Clearly, under the prior statutory framework, the Court of Appeals has said there is no problem before last session. But now we're dealing with this legal issue right now. That is why I think it's very important that this legislative session must address that issue between manslaughter 2 and criminally negligent homicide. You can, as the first bills do away with the defense totally, but at a minimum, you must address that issue, I believe, so that it is clear that there is a crime involved in this conduct.
Were you here when the criminal negligent homicide debate took place as to whether or not to grant the affirmative defense? If so, what year was that?
Well, Mr. Chair, murder by abuse back in 89 or 91, whenever that was when there was a decision that there should be a defense to the murder by abuse statute only. Last session is when that defense got brought into the manslaughters, and I really don't believe there was a lot of discussion about that issue. That's the problem. It certainly went over my head.
So going back to 89 and 91,
yes.
There had to be a conscious decision not to have the affirmative defense apply to criminally negligent homicide.
Mr. Chair, I think that's correct. But I also believe that there was the thought that it would also not apply, the defenses would not apply in the manslaughter. And the problem that's developed is the defense for manslaughter 2 with criminal negligence involved and no defense to criminal negligent homicide. I will simply put one other thing out and then quit, and that is that as a prosecutor, I would agree with Professor Turner that the facts of someone who has religious beliefs and practices prayer for their child, there is no way that I'm legitimately going to be able to charge them with murder and say that they have the intent to kill. There is no way that I'm going to legitimately be able to charge them with manslaughter 1 and argue that they have extreme indifference to the value of human life and engage in reckless conduct. I believe that the charges that are relevant are primarily criminal negligent conduct, possibly reckless conduct by itself. But I would note that the last conviction we have under this statute involved the charging of reckless conduct, but a conviction for criminally negligent conduct. And that was before the defense was put in the manslaughter, it's the prior statute. But that's why I believe the primary charge that is open when someone is actually using prayer is criminally negligent homicide. But that legal issue is still out there, and that's what generated the Oregonian articles and much of the other public discussion. I took longer than I intended, but that's the information I have for you.
Questions from Ken? Yes, Senator Brady.
So are you saying that in reality the only place that the defense needs to be deleted is the criminally negligent homicide, because that's where they're charged?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, I believe that you would solve the legal issue if the defense was modified in some way for the manslaughter 2 charge that uses criminal negligence as one of its elements. Having said that, I would say that our association does support the abolition of the defense because we do not believe this type of conduct will ever result in prosecutions of those higher crimes, similar to what Representative Starr said.
Mr. Chairman, just a follow-up. So your association favors elimination of the defense wherever it appears in the statute. Just wipe it out altogether.
Ms. Chair and Senator Burdick, yes.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you. Susan, you could identify yourself.
Yes. Senator Bryant, members of the committee, my name is Susan King. I'm a registered nurse representing the Oregon Nurses Association. My field is healthcare, not law, and I'm certainly glad of that because healthcare is complicated enough. And while it's been interesting to listen to the legal arguments, I've been asked to comment on the healthcare aspects of this bill. Our association does support the elimination of the affirmative defense that's contained in this discussion. Let me give you my view from the bedside, and I'd like to relate very briefly an experience that I had just yesterday. My clinical practice is in emergency nursing. Yesterday I had a man who was just a couple of days shy of his 71st birthday, who had end-stage lung disease, severe heart disease, and was admitted near death to the emergency room where I was practicing and became my patient. Despite the fact that the care that we were going to render to him was futile in terms of prolonging his life, he expressed a sincere wish that we do everything we could short of resuscitation to keep him comfortable but keep him alive. And we did so. We started medications to keep his blood pressure up. We gave him pain medication. We virtually did everything we could. He died a couple of hours after his admission. But we did everything that he asked us to do. One of the primary principles that guides my practice is that of self-determination. It's also a principle that we find elsewhere in Oregon law. Clearly, we find it in Oregon's Death with Dignity Act, and regardless of whether one is a proponent or an opponent of that act, I think there's broad agreement that it is the person's wishes, their own self-determination, that guides what we do. And that's what guides my practice as well. As an emergency nurse, I'm often confronted with patients who come in extremis, as we would say, and it's difficult to ascertain what their wishes are, but we do our best, either through talking with family, communicating with the patient, him or herself, when that is possible. I've seen many, many cases of child abuse, some resulting in death, others in resulting in disability or severe injury. I wouldn't be prepared to tell you that some of the cases I've seen are worse than a child dying of untreated diabetes or worse than seeing a child die of an appendicitis that could have been easily treated by surgical intervention. What I will tell you is it's clear to me that children are vulnerable, children are unable to make judgments about their health and about their well-being, and that it's up to Oregon to do everything that we can in our power to protect those children until such time that they are either able to make wise or unwise decisions. So I would urge your support, and I appreciate the opportunity to comment. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. King? Detective Green.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, my name is Jeff Green. I'm a detective for the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, and I've been employed in law enforcement in the state for over 14 years now. In my time as a detective and as a deputy for the county of Clackamas, I've seen a lot of things, traffic accidents and suicides, murders, assaults, and I've investigated the deaths of children. On February 23, 1998, I was brought to a house outside of Oregon City to investigate the death of an 11-year-old boy. His name was Bo Phillips. Bo Phillips died from complications from undiagnosed diabetes. And basically, his parents let him die. They prayed over his body, refusing to offer medical treatment to him. The reason that was is his family was members of the Followers of Christ Church, which Dr. Lumen talked about. Their belief is in healing by prayer instead of by medical means. Bo Phillips should be alive today. He should be worrying about why his voice is changing and why he's going to do for summer vacation as a 12-year-old and not in a cemetery outside of Oregon City. During this investigation, I learned many things. I learned that we should not prosecute parents who let their children die because of religious choices. I learned that Bo Phillips did not have a choice to live or die, that he died because of these parents' choices of religious belief. And I learned also that Mr. Phillips, Bo Phillips' father, made that choice for him. I looked into Bo Phillips' eyes when he was laying on the bed that night when there was literally hundreds of followers of Christ Church members in the house wandering around. And I saw a very vacant sign in his eyes, the signs of pain and signs of sadness. Bo Phillips died a painful death. The experts that I talked to and Bo Phillips' father told me that his son, and the experts said that his son suffered from fevers, excessive thirst, lost bladder control, could have slipped into convulsions before he eventually died. The experts also told me that both Phillips could be alive, possibly, if he was going to receive medical treatment within an hour of all this happening, within an hour of his death. But he never got to make that choice of whether he had his own religious prayer for the medical treatment, because his father took that away from him. Both Phillips' father was not prosecuted because of the statutes as they are now. Both Phillips' father is not by any way ignorant. He's not stupid. He's a very intelligent man. He knew how to call 911. He knew where the hospital was. He knew where the doctors were. He knew that his son was very sick, and in fact told me he thought his son could die 12 hours outside of his son dying, yet he took no actions. Well, Phil's father never had the answer to the death of his son. To me, this child was sacrificed in the name of God, and we're going into the 21st century. Sacrifices occurred on islands in the South Pacific and even in the Roman empires and all throughout civilization, but we're talking about the 21st century. We're talking about the internet, worldwide communication. Children should not be sacrificed. In my mind, both those are sacrificed. I'm asking you to pass this bill, House Bill 2494, along with Representative Lowe's amendments, as I read them just prior to coming in today. If both those death means anything, it should be that it should not be sacrificed in failing this year. Mr. Chair, you have any questions?
I think from the fact that you've given committee that Mr. Phillips could have been prosecuted for criminal negligence homicide, and the jury would have had to make that decision.
If not criminal negligence homicide, one of the degrees of manslaughter.
But even with the ambiguity that Ms. Finn talked about, that would have been an option that the district attorney had, and for some reason chose not to.
I don't make the prosecution decisions. I refer cases to the DA, and they make that decision, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Finn, earlier, I think you were in the room when Mr. Taylor asked the question about using the spiritual treatment as a mitigation factor in sentencing. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Mr. Chair, I think that is one potential way of dealing with the concern that people might be charged with these higher level crimes. As I've said, in practical terms, I do not believe that will occur. I do believe there is still that legal issue there, and I know, having spoken with the Clackamas County DA, she believes because there is criminal negligence in both manslaughter to incriminate homicide, that there's an equal protection problem, and that needs to be resolved. And that wouldn't resolve that issue for her. But that is the legal issue that I hope the committee addresses if it does nothing else, because then I think clearly criminal negligence homicide could be charged factually in these situations if that was removed.
Well, if you were the DA in Clackamas County and were given the fact situation, the report that Detective Green just handed you, would you have charged?
Mr. Chair, I'm not the DA in Clackamas County. I've learned long ago I need to see it in the police reports before I give an opinion.
Oh, well, let you go. Other questions for Mr. Green? Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I have one question from Detective Green, if I could. I'm curious, you were there during his last hours. How did you get involved? Did someone report this, or how did you? I'm just curious how you got involved.
Chair, Senator Duncan, I was not there during his last hours. The way the
he was not alive when you.
He was not alive when I arrived on the scene. The way the Clackamas County Medical Examiner's Office has dealt with Falls of Christ churches. If a member of the church dies, they notify the medical examiner's office. The medical examiner's office responds to the scene, makes determination if they need law enforcement assistance, and then calls the appropriate agency.
I guess I'm curious also something. If a child dies and no physician is involved, who is the first person to make contact?
Yeah.
So I call mortuary. others that come into play that you get involved, I guess.
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, law enforcement was contacted in this case by the Clackamas County Medical Examiner's Office. The church members called the medical examiner's office directly.
They always report it from the examiner.
They have, yes, that's the arrangement that has been made in our county with the church.
Okay, so that's just an arrangement that's been made.
Yes.
Okay, I was
curious. Thank you. Yes, Mr.
Chairman. Secretary Green, are you DME certified?
DMV certified?
DME certified. You have a medical examiner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Turner, no, I am not, but I've taken the course.
Thank you for your testimony. I'll invite then Grant Higginson, Vic Congleton, and either Bruce Hildy or Wendy Forge. And as you come forward, if you could each one of your testimony to 3 minutes, I would appreciate it. And of course, any written comments you have are more than welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Victor Congleton, Program Manager for Child Protection at Services to Children and Families. I can be brief. I think that Representative Lowe, Dr. Luhmann, and several of the other witnesses have done a really good job in describing the problem, and the direction has been laid out fairly clearly. SDF supports the efforts to remove the spiritual treatment exceptions from the relevant Oregon criminal and juvenile statutes, and to that end, we testified in favor of the original bill as it was introduced. The bill, as it's before you today, does only part of the job necessary to protect children. It changes some of the criminal code, but it leaves intact the exception to the mandatory reporting law for child abuse in Chapter 419. It's important that this exception to the child abuse reporting law be deleted as part of the overall effort to provide more effective protection for children. The -A13 amendments would accomplish this goal. I think I will add that in the conversation with Detective Green, if he described the arrangements or the agreements that have been reached in Clackamas County about notification in the medical examiner's office, for the most part, the folks who find themselves in these situations are rule followers. And if we lay out the rules for them and the people who are in contact with them, we'll be in a much better position to be able to protect children and save their lives. I'll answer questions later if you have any.
Committee, let's listen to all 3 witnesses and then ask questions. Grant, why don't you go next?
For the record, Joe Bryant, member of the committee. My name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the state health officer and deputy administrator for the Oregon Health Division. I also try to be very brief. As Dr. Luhmann mentioned, I, along with him, am the co-chair of the state child fatality review team, which was created in the 1995 legislative session, and our responsibility is to review child fatalities around the state of Oregon and to come up with recommendations for how future deaths might be prevented. Over the last year, we did review 3 cases, which Dr. Luhmann mentioned and described. Some of those cases were children who were treated by spiritual means only, died after a fairly prolonged illness. The state team felt that all of these deaths were preventable, and in an effort to try to prevent future deaths, one of our 2 legislative priorities for this session was to try to get the religious exemption removed from Oregon's homicide statute. I must admit I am very much a legal neophyte. I do not understand a lot of the arguments that are presented, and for me, the real issue is that we want to support a bill that ends the ambiguity. And from what little I can see, House Bill 2494, along with the -13 amendments, is a pretty clear statement and one that the Health Division supports. To me, it seems that while I was hoping to hear some of the opponents' issues before coming up here, a couple of things that I have heard that are going to be arguments. One is we don't want to make these good parents criminals, and I think that those issues have already been addressed. I agree with District Attorney Dale Pan that I find it hard to believe that unless there really are extreme extenuating circumstances that someone would be charged with actual murder. The other argument I can hear being raised is, why are we picking on spiritual treatment? And I would argue back, saying that I don't think we are, that in fact what we're trying to do is to make this all equal. That as far as I'm concerned, people should have the ability to choose whatever kind of primary health care they want to, whether that be spiritual, acupuncture, naturopath, or what most people use, allopathic medicine. However, when that primary means is not working and the child is becoming seriously ill, and particularly when they're close to death, at that point, no matter what you have chosen, you need to try something else. And to not try something else, I do believe, is negligent. And then the other thing that I would like to mention is I would like to respond a little bit to the Dash 10 amendments. I had not seen them until about 2 minutes ago. These are the ones that Representative Starr is suggesting we adopt. And the reason that I think I need to respond to that is because it mentions that this section only applies, exemption only applies if the parent or guardian of the dependent person notified the county health department of the county in which the dependent person was residing at the time of the treatment. By spiritual means. And first, I'm unclear what would happen with that phone call. And as you know, the local health departments are part of the public health system along with the state health division. It's unclear to me what would happen with that phone call. If we're simply just notifying us and then nothing happens, then I'm not sure what we're doing. On the other hand, if we were to be notified and were to go out and do some kind of evaluation, I do have some concerns. Number one is just the timeliness concern. Making that phone call when a child is seriously ill or close to death, I think, could prolong the time when the child is suffering and possibly actually facilitate that death. The second thing is that local health department people in general are not clinicians or emergency clinicians, and for them to be the people that are going out evaluating a seriously ill child, I'm just not sure that makes sense. And then the third thing is that I think that it just opens up some tremendous liabilities for the public health system. And with that, I'll close and be happy to answer any questions.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Wendy Berg. I'm a psychologist, and I represent the Oregon Professional Society on the Abuse of Children. We are a state chapter of a national organization committed to ensuring that children are able to live lives free from abuse and neglect. Our members are private citizens primarily and some public officials. Most care members consist of medical doctors, nurses, lawyers, psychologists, social workers, and police officers who are committed to children's well-being. My comments are very brief because most of what I would have to say has been said. We feel very strongly that the bill, House Bill 2494, should pass with the A13-A13 amendments because it provides equal protection under the law for all children. We feel like that's very important, both in the sense of communicating clearly to parents what they need to do in these situations when their child is near death. We also feel that while the freedom of religious expression is a fundamental right, we believe that the child's right to life is more fundamental and that the children are not able to make a decision for themselves in this circumstance. And the state needs to intervene and make sure that the child lives long enough to be able to make that decision for themselves. We also feel that these bills will save the parents from needless suffering, the parents, because it will provide a clear message to them and a deterrent for them in making the decision. We've heard testimony in the House from parents who have had more than one child die, and we feel like that's a terrible thing to let a parent live through, and they're in a terrible conflict situation when the religious community is telling them one thing and they're having to watch their child die. So we are strongly in favor of this bill. Thank you.
Questions? Yes, Senator Brown.
I actually have a question for Dr. Higgins. So, regarding the Dash 10 amendments, and I just looked at them as well, wouldn't that sort of set up a notification, a duty to notify under the Abuse Reporting Act, and then SCS kick in? I mean, I've seen the chart.
Chair Bryant, Senator Brown, yeah, I would think so, but if that's the case, why wouldn't the report simply go directly to SCS?
Okay.
All
right. Given the level of seriousness, given the level of seriousness in terms of illness that it looks like we're running back here, I assume under these cases that SCS likely removed these children from their homes, given... Isn't that right? I mean, that's probably not a good question for you. Sorry.
Maybe a better one for you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I can't make assumptions. I don't know at what point the report would come. I didn't get a copy of the dash 810.
Okay.
It's that'll really take some work if we want to take that approach. And listening to Dr. Higginson, I can see the call coming 10 minutes before the child dies to invoke the privilege and the exemption, but have no real effect on the outcome of the case. So I think we really have to do some serious thinking about this.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, one more question.
Yes, Senator Brown.
So Dr. Berg, does your organization have a position about children over the ages of 14 and whether they ought to make the decision, whether they ought to be in the position of choosing spiritual treatment versus medical treatment?
No, I haven't discussed with the members of my organization that particular issue.
Thank you.
Good question.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll now go into an hour of testimony from those who oppose, and I'll begin with Mr. Bruce Fitzwater. And Mr. Fitzwater, are there two other witnesses you'd like to have come forward at the same time with you?
I'd like to have
Steve Olson
and Dr.
Peterson. Okay, good afternoon.
Let me begin. Chairman Bryant, members of the committee. I want to just first say that I've just been very, very grateful for the quality of thought that you're bringing to this issue. Some of you know that I've been working on it for the whole term here, and it's the only thing I've really been focused on, and I haven't heard such clear discussions, concerned discussions to this point. And I'm just very grateful that we're looking at this level. I'm the representative of the Christian Science Church in the state of Oregon. I was a child of a Christian Science family in Oregon, and I learned to turn to God's love for healing as a child, and that's what I found was most effective for me in treating both emotional and physical problems in childhood diseases and athletic injuries. For the last 25 years, I've been a Christian Science practitioner in the Portland area and have met with individuals and helped them find sustained spiritual healing. I'll try to cut through my testimony and note that I think we're in agreement about how this thing came before us through Clackamas County. Our feeling is that there is a statute in Oregon. The criminal negligence statute could have been imposed if the facts of the case would bear it. We take Hardy Meyer's statement to be our clearest statement of those facts, that Oregon law does provide available homicide sanctions to be used in cases of parents who have not provided medical care to their children in circumstances where a reasonable person would have known there was a substantial risk of death. We feel that we live within that law, and our members are expected to be obedient to that law. If there is ambiguity about that state law, we would like to have it cleared up. We have introduced the dash 11 amendment, the A11 amendment, which is an attempt to do, I think, what you are considering doing here, clarifying that this is a crime, making it clear both to the parents and to the prosecutors. But our primary concern has been that the crime not be treated under Measure 11. We feel this would provide a mandatory minimum of 75 months and essentially kill the family. And we feel that, at this point there's no need for it to rise to that occasion. When professors of law say, well, gee, it won't happen, you know, that's where I just have to be unknowing about this. My sense is that a jury perhaps could stumble in. I see other states, people get convicted of second and third degree manslaughter. However, when their penalties are assessed, they are in accord with what we find for the first degree, they are in accord with criminal negligent homicide. Counsel Taylor has said that there's consideration of thinking about this in the work group, and we certainly would be glad to contribute a criminal lawyer to look at this section to work it out. Now, we would like to move off of the criminal negligent homicide provision to the other provisions in this bill, because we actually feel the other provisions are much more important to us as a religion, and we think to the people of Oregon, as people who are practicing therapies and taking care of our families, than the homicide provision, however we finally get that clear. What is the essence of this, as has been noted by previous speakers, is the definition of child abuse, ORS 419B005. And the juvenile court statute 419B100. The original 2494 bill went far beyond the clarification of the homicide statute. And it's gone beyond that to criminalize what is a peaceful, successful, and rewarding way of life, really, for thousands of Oregonians. The House bill before you, the engrossed minority report, removed the greatest of these impositions. In deleting the bill's proposed amendments to the child abuse statute, the reporting statute, and the criminal non-support statute. And now you're being asked to reintroduce these through the various amendments, 12 and 13, the ones we've seen. We haven't really gotten to see 10 yet, clearly. Now, what both sides in this issue want is good health and good health care for their children. And we truly want a balance between the cherished values of parents to nurture their children with their best values and the state's ability to intervene if a parent's decisions for the child are seen to be ineffective in meeting that child's needs. What some of the remarks from Dr. Higginson, I find a great deal of sympathy with, that we want a situation where we have where people in our diverse and pluralistic society are able to bring to their children their cherished, diverse range of healing practices and thoughts. In addition, I think now more than ever, people of different faith backgrounds are increasingly looking to spirituality as a means of restoring and preserving their health. We're entering a new millennium, and it's not the time to impose by the state on every family, down to last detail, the mode of health care decisions which should be made for their children. Unfortunately, this is what the removal of the affirmative of the accommodation in the child abuse definition would do. We feel that the state does not have a serious public interest here or a compelling interest in intervening in the normal, everyday family affairs and health care decisions when parents are showing themselves to have every evidence of making good choices for their children. The analogy that I would offer to you is that of a bar, like a high jump bar. Removing the spiritual healing accommodation, as the different amendments, proposed amendments would, could be characterized as criminalizing any form of treatment and healing which, though it provides no harm, is not currently administered by the medical establishment. We feel parents should be endeavoring to provide health care and excellent health care to their children, though that care need always not be medical. To demand health care alone would be to lay the bar right on, to demand medical care alone would be to lay the bar right down on the ground on top of each family. we desire, and we feel the majority of people in Oregon desire, room under that bar for reasonable decisions for their families when the welfare of the child is not endangered. We all know the decision of when to call in medical authorities, when to accept their advice in cases of minor illness, whether to use homeopathic, naturopathic, Asian remedies for diseases, is something that, in practice, citizens in this state are considering daily and usually with great reasonableness and success. We feel that our record in the practice of Christian Science in Oregon over the last 100 years, with 39 churches, confirms this. We're before you, this is our practice, and we're not even under the spotlight in terms of being the focus of criticism here. Our vision for society is that we want responsible parents carefully watching over their children, their children's morality, their companions, their books, their computer programs, and these parents should be thoughtfully making decisions. When parents are choosing from the broad array of palette of different counseling, therapies, treatments, prayers, healing traditions in our pluralistic society, we think we're going to have the best possible care for each child. Now, in the vast majority of cases, this model is going to be successful and decisions will be made correctly. However, we recognize that there may be some individuals in society whose decisions regarding their children's health care are not going to be effective, as Dr. Higginson spoke of. In these cases, we support the state's ability to rapidly intervene, to investigate, and to mandate the treatment which the state feels it has a compelling interest to impose to prevent serious harm to the child. Here, the Oregon Statute 419D-100, subsection 3, provides the pivotal point of balance, allowing the state to investigate and to intervene with the health care remedy it deems best. That statute provides the balance. It says the parents are able to provide spiritual healing, but when there is a threat of the welfare of the child, the state can trump it with its preferred remedy. For this system to work, it must be clearly enforced and consistently enforced. We support that. From the information we have received from the press, it appears that the current laws have not for some time been carefully enforced in the very county where indeed the greatest violations have occurred. There is evidence that the attention which this matter has already received has alerted county authorities to utilize the provisions under the current law. So we feel that past failures in enforcement in one county should not be allowed to limit the reasonable practice of thousands of Oregon citizens. Thank you.
All right.
Why don't we hear all three and then we'll open up for questions. So, who would like to go next?
I will, Mr. Chair. My name is Steve Moulton. I am here today a father of three boys, as a practicing lawyer from the state of California and state of Oregon, and to speak to the issues, I was going to talk somewhat on the criminal law side of this and the abuse statute, but I am going to focus my remarks orally to the abuse statutes. I too would like to express my appreciation for the thoughtful consideration here today. I have spoken before this committee and the House committee in two separate sessions previously, and have had the privilege of testifying to some of you who are here today before on this on related matters here. The crux of the issue before you with this bill, in my view, is the enforcement of existing law. The amendments proposed, the -12 amendments and several of the others, would ask you to remove from existing law the balancing, what I refer to as the balancing provisions in law, to accommodate the varying beliefs and practices of those who would rely on other than allopathic medicine. We have in our statutes, which Mr. Fitzwater cited in Chapter 419B, a very carefully crafted set of child reporting and investigation statutes. These were put in place in Oregon law beginning back in 1971 and over time have gone through a series of revisions, but the core of the reporting investigation statute has remained constant. The problem that we have today is it simply has not been enforced, and those who are charged with its enforcement, the reporting officials listed under the statute, simply either are not aware of their responsibility or the breadth of their opportunity to use this statute when they feel there is reasonable cause for them to institute the reporting procedures. In addition, I am not personally aware of if there are judicial shortcomings in a court's failure to exercise its jurisdiction. I do not believe this to be the case. I believe if there is a shortcoming, it is as exhibited in Clackamas County, where the DA just simply does not bring the case for the court on the prosecution side, and where there is a failure to report or bring a matter to a court to attempt to remove a child to provide medical care, as in the case of both Phillips. My written comments contain a fairly systematic summary of the reporting statutes, and I will not go through those in detail with you today. But I would like to point out that the accommodations provided in 419B005 do, in conjunction with the 419B100 balancing provisions, recognize that from the very start, allopathic medicine is by default in society the choice of care. Now, there's no explanation for this, but that's the state of society. Those who would rely on other forms of care are on an unlevel playing field, so to speak. And by having the balancing provisions in the statute, this does give some recognition to the fact that there are other viable forms of health care available. How does this relate to me? I'm a father of three young boys, from a toddler up to an eight-year-old. My wife and I have been Christian Scientists all our lives, and we're both fourth-generation Christian Scientists. I have experienced many healings individually myself. My wife and I have experienced healings through Christian Science, prayer, and treatment of medically diagnosed conditions, other so-called severe conditions, all of which have been healed effectively and quickly. I would say that my parents did not subject me to abuse or harm growing up. Quite the contrary, I felt that I received the most loving care, and it's natural for me to want to provide that kind of care for my children. I know that I share that feeling with many other parents who are raising their children under a spiritual means for healing and care in their lives. If the accommodations and the recognition of spiritual healing are removed from the abuse statutes, as Mr. Fitzwater pointed out, the standard under which reports could be made would be dropped virtually to the ground. That would have a tremendous chilling effect on me personally and my family in knowing what to do if there were cases where our children were experiencing physical difficulties. We have always sought to treat anything that has arisen with spiritual treatment and have always been successful. But if now there is a situation where a school official, anyone else in the list of reporting persons is put in a position of having to report because they know that I'm a Christian Scientist, what does that cause me to have to do as a parent? Do I have to fear that I will be brought into the reporting procedure and have a full investigation begun? The statute seems to require that. I disagree with the notion that was presented that the people who are listed in the statute could not report, cannot report if there is a parent who is relying on spiritual means for healing. That is not the case. The statute, in fact, says that there shall be a report made if there is reasonable cause to believe. The recognition of the statute simply says that
the fact that a person relies on spiritual means for treatment alone does not, by itself, constitute reasonable cause. There must be some other element to it. Without the recognition language in the statute that exists presently, it would remove any element of a showing of harm or anything other than a showing that the person is relying on spiritual means. Almost de facto, if I told someone that I was a Christian Scientist and relied on spiritual means for healing, they could report me saying that I am abusing my children because I am providing spiritual treatment and not providing medical care. There's no need to show that my children are at harm if those accommodations that are presently in the law are removed. Again, the important aspect of the issue before you, I believe, is simply the enforcement of the existing provisions. It's not changing something. It's hard to say that that we shouldn't do something when we have cases like the children who are were the cause of this whole procedure to start in Clackamas County. Those are tragic circumstances, clearly. But the doing something should be to enforce the laws that we have, to train the reporting agents more effectively as to what their responsibilities are and the limits of the spiritual accommodation that exists.
And I was going to say hold the questions, but I need to ask you too. And I'm the chair, so I can
certainly. Right. In the Clackamas County situation, which was a different religion, the tenets of the of your religion at some point allow you then to seek medical assistance if the if your spiritual healing treatments aren't successful? There's a very I guess I should defer that question if you don't mind on a theological issue to Mr. Fitzwater. I'd be happy to answer from my personal opinion, but I believe he'd be better.
All right.
As an individual, my personal opinion is that the church, and I believe it is a very common misconception among the public that members of the Christian Science Church are obligated to not seek medical care, to not take medicine, and if they are to do so, that they would be excommunicated or otherwise lose some benefit of their membership or affiliation with the church. That is absolutely false. I, as an individual practitioner of Christian Science, am free to make my individual choice as to my own care and the care of my own children. I may seek medical care for my children and not for myself, and there is no dictate from the church that I do one thing or another. I could seek allopathic care, I could seek homeopathic, acupuncture. Whatever I choose to do is where I feel confident with my level of demonstrating my ability to heal through prayer or otherwise.
Thank you, Chairman Bryant. Let me just expand on that answer. The church says of the individual, you have the obligation, the right, and conscience to make your own decisions, and it makes that a very strong premise in our church. We have a teaching about spiritual healing, and if someone decides not to follow that teaching in a specific case, then that's their business. And it does not have an adverse effect within our church culture or theologically, with some exceptions, and I'm one of the exceptions. I'm someone who has for 25 years been working with people, praying with them for spiritual healing, on basically in situations, most of the situations where people are not using medical means. Sometimes there's some correspondence. If I would myself decide to use medicine, I would be a hypocrite working with people who are working with women. And that would be something I would have to step down, not from the church, but from the position that I am occupying in the church.
That's your individual decision.
That's my individual decision, and it would apply to the people who are the Christian Science practitioners of the church. They are expected to withhold this standard themselves, not to leave the church when they, but to step back.
I might check if they ask the weenie question that you should ask.
No, I violated the rule. We'll never ask questions.
So you're still an elder.
In a sense, you could say that.
So you're held to a higher standard.
I'm held to a higher standard. Senator.
Senator.
Are your children held to the same standard?
I don't have children, and they are not at all.
They're
nor right. Is my wife.
Well, that's true of all of us.
Thank you for listening.
He's listening right now.
His wife ain't married, J. Glow.
Senator Duncan.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have a question. And it's hard to put yourself in the situation of the family and the young boy who died. But if you were called upon in a situation where someone is dying and you knew that the possibility for medical treatment was available, you would not advise them to seek medical help at that point. Is that...
That's an agonizing question.
I'm sure it is.
But let me address it. I've been a Christian Science practitioner for 25 years, and I have never been involved in the death of a young person, and I have never avoided working with the case because I thought of this within the church.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in a case like that, I would do what I always do, which is pray very hard from the very beginning. My office as a Christian Science practitioner, in most cases, would not to say, oh yes, you should take this child to a doctor. My office does not really include that option.
Mm-hmm.
But if I felt the family was not really holding to, I would say, a standard of spirituality that was going to be effective in healing, then I would probably step back from that case, and I would have to, I mean, I don't know if I would give some hand signals that say maybe this is something else. I've never had to face that directly. But I am concerned with the life of that child. And I think this is the point that we want to make very clearly. We're concerned with healing. Now, we have a different method of healing. But we're not saying that parents are going to go to heaven if you don't give your child medicine. That's not at all what we're talking about. These parents and myself are bringing what we feel is the most effective spiritual healing, the most effective healing in many ways, that we can bring forth. And we understand that the society has a default for allopathic medicine, and in situations that get to a certain point, it may demand that medicine. We can understand that parents will, if the situation gets to a certain level, will do that. And that's often the way spiritual healing is practiced. Christian Scientists, which I usually work with, are frequently married people who aren't Christian Scientists. And so you have some symptoms, and you have a situation where, well, dad's concerned or mom's concerned, and if he's not better in the morning, we're going to see the doctor. And it's often in those situations that we have wonderful spiritual healing.
And I think it's clear probably that the group that's been described as followers of Christ are not a branch of the Christian Scientists.
No, our theology and outlook are, I think, very, very apart on the spectrum of beliefs. Our great little distance between us.
And I don't know if we have others who are trying to testify, and maybe they're the follower of Christ member here today, but that'll be
I was looking at that list, and I didn't see anybody who was just curious if they were going to be testifying.
Well, we will certainly invite them to testify here. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Chairman Bryant, Senator. My name is Connie Eldridge Pedersen. I'm a licensed psychologist. I've been licensed in the state of Oregon since 1994. And I'm also a Christian Scientist, although I'm not in the same category as Mr. Fitzwater. As I was sitting here listening to the testimony today, I was struck by the fact that I grew up in Clackamas County, and I was raised by a Christian Science mother and a father who was a recovering alcoholic who primarily lived out his spiritual beliefs through Alcoholics Anonymous, but he also did attend church with my mother. And I was thinking about something that happened. I don't know if I was 11 or 12, but I do know I missed my sixth grade field trip over an illness that I had at that age. And I had what my mother thought was rheumatic fever. And this was 1967 or 68, so it predates everything that we've talked about so far, even the 71 rules. But I do know that at the time that I had rheumatic fever, my mother asked me, she said she and my dad had talked about it and said, do you want to work on this in Christian Science? And I said, yes, I did want to be healed through prayer. And so she called a practitioner, and the first thing the practitioner said was, you need to get out the book that we have that it is a statement of rules concerning spiritual healing, of laws enacted by the state or the United States. And then the practitioner called the Committee on Publication, which is the office that Mr. Fitzwater, one of the offices Mr. Fitzwater holds currently. And the person who is the Committee on Publications of the State of Oregon said, you need to call the county. So they called the county medical examiner, and someone in Sandy, I know the doctor who came out, and I assume that he was designated as a representative for the county medical examiner in our area, because I know he just had a private practice. He came to see me, diagnosed me, and said I did indeed have rheumatic fever, and said that this would be the medical treatment he would offer. And we talked about that, he and my mother and I. And he left, and then my mom said again, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I think I want to continue to work with the practitioner and rely on prayer. So my mother, the practitioner, and I spoke together every day and prayed. And it took a fair amount of time. I think that I missed about 4 weeks of school, and during that time I was not able to walk or use my arms for part of the time. And I had a complete and full healing, and I know that the doctor came out to visit one more time during that time. So I would like to make the statement that Christian Scientists are members of the community who obey laws. And one of the things that was said earlier was that you don't want to make discrimination against denominations, which I think is a very important point. But the long history of the Christian Science Church has caused, at least in my understanding, for the church to make some accommodations to the laws of the states in which they live in. And this is one of the ways in which we do that. We have accredited practitioners, and we have things like the Committee on Publication and quite a bit of acquaintanceship with the laws so that we don't do anything wrong. And I think sometimes Christian Scientists kind of overcompensate by being a little more strict about things just because we want to be seen as law-abiding citizens. So that's just something that came up while I was sitting here. I was thinking about. I earned a bachelor's degree from Principe College in 1977. It's in Illinois. A master's degree from the University of Oregon in 1981, and a PhD from the University of North Texas in 1989. And as I said, I've been practicing as a psychologist since 1994. Before that, I was doing my residency here in Portland. I've been working as a counselor to children and their families since 1976. And most of my professional life has been around providing services to people in poverty, those in severe emotional crisis, and primarily those with addictions to alcohol and other drugs. I recently learned a Zulu proverb, which I was thinking about in preparation for today. It says that a human being becomes a human being because of the care of other human beings. And I've really been struck by that today, because the work that you're doing, the work of the people who are supporting the bill, our colleagues who spoke before us, as well as myself, are definitely all trying to do that. We're trying to support other human beings becoming good human beings. I'm speaking today as a parent, a psychologist, and an educator to say that I have seen firsthand the effects of child abuse and neglect for over 20 years. I've counseled, taught, assisted, and consulted with thousands of children who were raised by parents in terrible distress. Many of these parents are still teenagers, at least emotionally, if not chronologically, and most have been traumatized in some way themselves. Almost all have turned to drugs, alcohol, gambling, sex, or crime to help them escape from pain. These attempts at avoidance have almost always harmed their children. Concurrently, I've been a member of the Christian Science Church since 1968. I joined when I was 14. I've known thousands of Christian Scientists in Oregon, throughout the United States, and abroad. None of them would fall into the aforementioned category. I've known families who've experienced financial ruin, divorce, and severe physical problems, including death, but not one of the Christian Scientists I've known throughout the past 40 years comes even close to the levels of abuse and neglect that my students encounter every day. For the past 4 years, I've been supervising 24 intern students in a master's degree program, and I routinely consult with 40 or 50 of the other students off and on throughout the year. This year, at least 10 of my students have worked with children and or their parents where termination of parental rights is being pursued. One is a child who's been returned to her mother 3 times despite severe sexual abuse. This woman's had her parental rights terminated in the case of her 4 other children, but still the state is attempting to save this family. All of the situations in which my students are currently working involve severe mental illness and or alcohol and drug problems. I've been trained to evaluate, intervene, and make recommendations in these cases. I recognize child abuse because, unfortunately, I'm all too familiar with it professionally. Members of organized religions who conscientiously care for their children through prayer are not child abusers, even if their children are not cared for by traditional Western medicine. Many of my clients rely on tribal customs or acupuncture for most severe problems. And many of my clients have been denied medical treatment due to a lack of money. I heard someone say earlier today that everyone is, should be receiving equal treatment, and I just don't think we're there financially in this state, even with the Oregon Health Plan. Medical care is not always successful either. My father died from a medical mistake. He was given hepatitis C in a blood transfusion when there was no cure for it. And I've personally experienced 4 miscarriages. One was while I was working as a Christian Science practitioner, and 3 were while I was working with a fertility specialist and an OBGYN, and I guess that speaks to the point that you were asking earlier. Christian scientists consider their own conscience. I believe that most of us pray daily and try to have deep communion with God and make decisions based on what's right. My husband is not a Christian scientist, and I needed to think about what was best for me and my family. And I experienced personal tragedy in all 4 cases, so I wasn't able to say that traditional medicine was successful, more successful than Christian Science, or Christian Science was more successful than the other. But I have never received any criticism from fellow church members for my actions, nor should that have affected my choice. I believe that when we undertake becoming parents, we understand that sacrifices have to be made, and those sacrifices should be made by us, not by our children. And I don't think that there's any responsible person who would deny treatment to their child because of fear of what a member of the church would say. That doesn't happen in Christian Science that I'm aware of anyway, but I think that's a frightening reason. It's kind of like treating your child like a car and what the neighbors want. I'm a licensed psychologist who routinely consults with psychiatrists, physicians, and nurse practitioners about psychotropic medications. I am not saying that I'm a typical Christian scientist. As far as I know, I'm the only Christian science psychologist in the entire country. But I will say that I'm well respected by the Christian science community and have always been treated with care and kindness by this group of caring, thoughtful people who are trying to love their families, old people as well as children, as they participate in the broader community of other good citizens. Christian scientists are people who are teachers and accountants, attorneys, construction workers, beauticians and homemakers who are trying to live their lives in accordance with the teachings of Jesus. This is not where the suffering is. These are not people who murder children. Terrible mistakes happen as part of the human condition, but I would urge you to protect children who are being treated with neglect, cruelty, and hatred. We already have legal mechanisms in place to make sure the children whose parents rely on prayer alone are identified and assisted. I think that in view of what's happened in Littleton and in Georgia, we're all thinking a lot more about protecting children in our society. And I recently had an opportunity to hear Dr. David Elkind, who's a renowned child development specialist, speak at Lake Ridge Junior High School. And he said, the only way a peer group achieves prominence in an adolescent's life is in order to fill the parental void. And I've been thinking about that a lot because I have several adolescents. Most members of organized religions are attempting to make sure that they're highly present in their children's lives through love, guidance, education, monitoring, prayer. Christian scientists are parents who are constantly attempting to define responsible parenting through teaching principles of prayer and reliance on God in all situations. Let's support these efforts and turn the state's attention to the true criminals, those who cannot and will not provide foundations and springboards for their children. And I've also included as part of my written testimony a very brief review of an article that was mentioned earlier from the Academy of Pediatrics. I didn't know, this is the first time I've done this, so I just jotted down ideas, and if you'd like to ask me questions about...
We have it.
Okay.
And this was an additional paper that was given.
And I am a clinician. I am not a researcher, but I do have some beliefs about things that were written in this article. So thank you for your attention, and I'm glad to answer any questions as well.
Questions for this panel? Senator Brown.
I want to have a discussion about the abuse reporting piece, and so I assume at least you three are concerned about the Dash 13 amendments, about express concern about being persecuted because of your religious beliefs under the abuse reporting statute. And I guess I would ask it the other way. As I see it, what the amendment does is put all children on an equal footing regardless of religious beliefs, and I just throw that out to you and ask you to respond.
Chairman, Senator Brown, I believe that it does not put all children on an equal footing from the standpoint that society, by what we experience now, defaults to allopathic medicine. Thus, those children who are from families who would seek to rely on other means of care are on an unlevel playing field. The existing provisions in law bring a recognition of that fact and say to the reporting officials that you cannot or should not report just simply because you know that person is relying on spiritual needs for treatment. If you have some other reasonable basis, if you feel that there is a condition that suggests there is harm occurring to that child physically or emotionally, report. Report. You have to. But otherwise, don't report just because you know that person is a Christian scientist or a follower of Christ or any other religion, just simply for that fact alone.
This is all. I'm assuming if your child, for example, had a cold, that would not be considered harm to your child. But if your child had a much more serious illness, I can't think of anything, but one of the illnesses diabetes untreated, that would rise to the level of reporting under the statute. I'm assuming a teacher that had exposure to your child with your child having a cold, the teacher wouldn't report. But if the teacher was aware or concerned that your child was experiencing a diabetic condition and not being treated medically, then the teacher would have a duty to report.
Senator Brown, through the chair, I can't speak to what each teacher would do or their level of training or understanding of what a symptom might suggest, but I think directly answering your question, that's true. If one of my children's teacher witnessed or saw symptoms that she felt suggested there was a diabetic condition, for instance, then I would expect that she would report that and invoke the reporting and investigation statutes that we have. And it would give her authority to do that, despite the fact that she would know that I'm a Christian Scientist and that our children go to Christian Science Sunday School.
Okay. Frederick.
Well, to get back to your point about the abuse statute that you had concerns about, some situations are not life-threatening, but are nevertheless agonizing. I think of my daughter's ear infections that she went through about a year and a half when she was three. And it was, I'll never forget, just, you know, the 12 hours it took during the night before you could call the doctor in desperation to get the antibiotics to get rid of this hideous pain. And I'm just wondering what your... if you have a child who is in terrible pain or terrible distress, even though it's not life-threatening, whether you know that appropriately belongs in abuse if it's not dealt with, either through spiritual means or if they don't work through another means.
Chairman Bryant, Senator Burdick,
One of our testifiers is going to speak very quickly of a child's situation with an ear problem. As a Christian Science practitioner, I would say I frequently find almost instantaneous healings in situations like this. I mean, I don't diagnose them, but I come over the phone. And I understand a suffering child is a heartache and a problem to the child and the parent, and I'm up sometimes all night working with situations like this. We do not condone suffering. We do not value suffering for even spiritual reasons. We want to end this. We feel we are working at it effectively. If a parent finds that the situation is not being met through their Christian Science treatment, that parent has the responsibility and right to find what's going to be most effective for them. My experience, frankly, in growing up as a Christian Science child, watching Christian Science children growing up, looking at other kids, is these kids are not suffering kids. I mean, overall.
Could I speak to that?
Yes.
Chairman Bryant, and this is both to Senator Brown's question as well as Senator Burdick's. I think that one of the concerns that Mr. Moulton was speaking about is the perception that not relying on Western medicine means that you're doing nothing, that it becomes a neglectful situation because prayer is not seen as the first choice for most people. So the thing that can happen sometimes is that well-meaning people, I mean, I'm a mandated reporter in the state, so I understand that, you know, when sometimes I report things that SDF doesn't think are situations of abuse, and I would always rather over-report than under-report, and I would hope that teachers do too. And so I think that one of the things that could happen is you could get in a situation of having somebody say, oh, this is, you know, one of these creepy people who's a Christian Scientist. They neglect their children. They don't do anything right for them, and so then they become targeted. I know that did happen to me in one situation as a child. At the time, we were allowed exemptions from health class because of Christian Science when studying diseases, and I had a teacher who was a member of another religion, and she became very, very, very angry with me every time I was excused from health. And so I know what that's like. I don't know if it's a good enough reason to not have the law, but I do think that we have to recognize that the law is carried out by human beings, and, you know, there's a lot of discretion there.
Can I correct quickly?
Do you make any distinction between illness and accident? It's a very serious automobile accident. No question. They're bleeding badly. They may not even make it in time to get into the hospital. What about that? I'm not sure I'm Christian, but what about
that? I understand that, you know, when you're growing up, if you're a Christian Science kid, your friends always ask, what happens if you fell down and dropped on your head? And
well,
we really believe in God's care, and that includes the whole situation. Okay. Often a Christian Scientist will find themselves unconscious, they'll find themselves bound up, they'll get to the hospital, and they say, I would like you just to take care of me, keep me warm, and they make the decision.
You don't make the decision. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. No, we don't.
One last question.
For Dr. Peterson, I guess there was that case recently in Eugene of a family that had a baby, and the mother, I believe, was HIV positive, and the state came in and got involved. And I guess, having, I've also been involved in the juvenile system for the past few years, but I guess my question would be, there are obviously folks in this country that look at the scientific information that we have differently, and I appreciate the fact that we have a constitutional amendment regarding religion, but we also have some pretty strong constitutional amendments, constitutional provisions regarding the privacy of the family. And I guess so my question would be, why provide a religious based exemption? Why not have it based on the family's decision in terms of level of health care?
Well, Senator Bryant and Senator Brown, I feel very strongly about that case. I guess that one of the primary thing that I can say, and this is, I believe, just as a private citizen who happens to be a Christian Scientist, I have a lot of opinions about things. You know, I'm not really sure that electricity works because I don't understand how it does, but it seems to every time I turn on the switch. So I kind of have to take some things on faith. I believe that for the care of children, we should have a systematic understanding of why things happen the way we do. As Christian Scientists, we don't get to pick and choose which things we like and which things we don't like. Being a Christian Scientist is not the easiest thing in the world. It requires consistent dedication to principles that are kind of difficult to carry out. And I don't think that it would be possible to say you can have a disease that you accept for yourself and know that it will not be transmitted to a child. There's a certain inconsistency in that case that I find unbelievable. Just, you know, I think that the thing about being a Christian Scientist is you can't go out and party all night and then pray to get rid of a hangover. You know, it doesn't work that way. you have to follow it from beginning to end.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
I'm a Presbyterian, Jim. I'm just curious because as I listened to the discussion today, and I had a woman in my office several weeks ago who, her point was that she had a child, she was a Christian Scientist, had a child die, and since that time she has really gotten concerned. You probably know of her. I mean, she's a rather prominent national person in this area. And I guess, as I've been listening to the discussion, all of a sudden my comfort zone was, well, they're taking care of all this. This wouldn't happen. But I guess what I'm asking is our current laws, with the current law we have on the books, if that were to happen, could one be prosecuted? I'm probably not making that very clear.
Depends on the fact situation, but probably for criminally negligent homicide, depending on what the facts were.
Right. Okay. I'm just trying to, she was a Christian Scientist and lost her child. And she knows good and well it was because of that decision. Okay.
We had a very patient representative here, Representative Julie Ianella, and so I told her I'd put her on after this panel. We've enjoyed the discussion, and
thank
I'm sure you'll remain
you.
In the room, but it's a courtesy in the Senate and the House to invite a representative or senator to come testify, and so we'll do that right now.
Chairman Bryant, I need to say that I will not be able to stay. I have a class that's meeting, but I can answer any questions later on.
All right.
At the discussion. Thank you.
Representative, you come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee. For the record, my name is Julie Gianella, and I'm the representative for House District 38. I'm a member of the House Judiciary Criminal Law Committee, and I've heard all the stories against and for the bill. And this bill deals with a very sensitive subject matter that I agonized over. The subject that concerns me is that I want to protect the children, but at the same time, I don't want to destroy our religious rights or freedom. And what I'm going to speak about is the committee report. I know you have a number of amendments, and I apologize for not having studied them all. I just quickly came down here and found out about this. And so what I'd like to speak to is the committee report that we voted on the floor. And I was surprised that we had a minority report, and we had a quick caucus for 5 minutes, and everything seemed to switch. And I'll tell you what concerned me and the difference of the two reports. As far as what we talked about, what I heard them talking about, the different things with the children being sick, the part that concerns me mainly is the death and the number of years served. So that's what I will speak to. I'm not an attorney. I'm a farm wife. And so I'll leave all the technical questions to the attorneys. but I'll share with you what was on my heart and how I agonized over protecting children and not destroying the religious freedoms and rights that we have in this state. Because I know that we are so careful to support all these other freedoms in Oregon. And the committee report for House Bill 2494 is what I felt was the best compromise to protect the children without destroying the religious freedom. I was deeply saddened when the minority report passed the House because I believed that the punishment did not fit the crime. The parents were not intentionally killing their children for their cause. And I am not a member of either of those churches. If I had a baby and I prayed for it and it wasn't getting well, I would get it to the doctor as fast as I could. I don't believe the parents should get a 20-year prison sentence. From the testimony that I heard in committee, I understand the vast majority of the parents would take their children to a doctor or a hospital if there were a law. That's the way we understood from the people who had been members of this particular church, that if there was a law, they were law-abiding citizens, they would take them to a doctor. The church does not want to break the laws, and they would ask the parents to take the children to a doctor if the children needed to be seen. We felt like that would solve most of the problems. I would recommend that the committee adopt the amendments that would reduce the jail time from a maximum of 20 years to a much shorter maximum of 3 years. The parents would still suffer from a 3-year maximum. Not only would they serve some jail time, which is a deterrent, but they would also probably lose their other children and break up their families. If they had 3 children and they prayed for a baby, believing that it was going to get well, and the baby died, they would lose their other 2 children, and they'd be serving time in prison. The other 2 children would have no parents. Their mother would be in jail until they were grown. I just felt like 20 years was too much for someone who believes that God would heal his or her children. And the last thing they want is for their precious children to suffer or die. But they follow their religion. If there's any law requiring that the parents take their children to seek medical attention, whether it's a 3-year or a 20-year maximum, the churches will encourage the parents to follow the law. I urge you not to punish the parents any more than what is necessary. And I really think this is a new step. I think it will solve the problem, protect the children, and serve as a deterrent. Not only do the parents have to suffer at the hands of the state, but also they will have to lose a baby or a child because of their beliefs. Please support the bill with a shorter sentence. Thank you for your time.
Questions from the representative? And we've been joined by another representative. Floyd, did you wish to testify on this bill, or are you here just to pass the evening?
Possibly support my idea.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I have not had an opportunity to hear all the testimony today, being another committee, but I did tell a couple people I was planning on coming down just to put on the record that the minority report that became the committee report was basically an opportunity to try to keep something alive to move forward for your consideration. There was a lot of discussion that went on, and my intent in forming that and coming to the various positions that were in that bill was to deal with the more egregious acts that could, in fact, constitute a murder by abuse, as well as manslaughter in the first degree, but still recognize some type of independence for parents to be able to provide care for their children to the means they believe is appropriate, but at the same time not allowing an unbridled check of that that right that they may have as an individual practicing their religion. What we attempted to do within the bill that you have before you is to provide for the child's best interest where the state could, in fact, if necessary, step in to make some decisions that would be necessary in the interest of the child, even though they may be counter to the parents and their spiritual or faith beliefs. Now, I understand that you have a lot of different amendments. I actually had one set that was drafted on behalf of the Services for Children and Family I'm not sure what the number of those are, but at some point you will, I understand you've already have heard some testimony from Rick Conklin.
We suspect there's a dash 14.
Thank you. And in my discussions with them, I told them that at the point of when we were looking at this in the House side, the bill itself was in a lot of jeopardy. And I know that there's a lot of coal friction that you and yourself will have to decide what, if any, to go to move forward with what, if any, new or additional provisions through the amendment. Our goal is basically to make certain that the child is protected where they are, until they are at the age where they can make decisions for themselves, and that parents in practicing their religious beliefs have to also understand that the child's best interest may override those beliefs and interests. That's basically all I wanted to say at this point. I understand that you have heard and will continue to hear as to some significant changes from what you have before you as to modifying the bill in either direction. And it's one of those situations that you, I know, will use your best judgment. I do want to recognize that this is a defense that we put in 1995, my first session. My understanding is only 7 states that currently have this in there. And regarding the concerns of Representative Janelle as to an individual receiving a Measure 11 sentence, that clearly was one of the concerns that we heard in our committee, as you will recognize. 3 of the homicide statutes, murder, manslaughter in the first degree, as well as manslaughter in the second degree, are all Measure 11 offenses. Murder is 25, not 20 years, and that was one of the discussions we had. And what we heard throughout our committee process was that everyone believed, or most everyone believed, that these parents should in fact be held accountable, but they were concerned about what type of sanction they would receive. I'm not here to discuss the impact of Measure 11 except that I believe anyone that meets those elements that need to be proven in a court of law should be held accountable to the same level as anyone else under our current laws, as long as we have that in place. At some point, maybe we will have the wisdom and the foresight to allow for something in the sense of presumptive sentencing to give discretion back to the court in applying the sentence that may be appropriate. That did, in fact, cause a havoc and chaos within our committee, and that's why the original committee report came out of my committee structured the way it did, as to trying to limit the exposure for a longer sentence. Again, my concern is that we need to look at that in a globalistic approach as compared to one bill, and this bill is not the mechanism to do it anyway. But what I do want to leave you with is that if an individual is found guilty of murder by abuse and they raise the defense of faith healing, I would ask you to consider the elements that had to be proven before they reached the determination of guilt. And I would tell you, in my opinion, in my discussions with other prosecutors around this state, it's our opinion that if a parent is truly exercising their religious or spiritual belief, that the court will never, through either a jury or through a trial by the to the judge, find those parents or parent or guardian guilty of murder by abuse, because the threshold is so great, and I believe that that those individuals who are truly practicing their spiritual beliefs will never be found guilty, let alone charged with that serious of a crime. And that's why we structured the other provisions to make certain that someone can be held accountable to the lower degrees of homicide.
The risk, though, of moving the defense was to have an overzealous prosecutor who would not ever intend to try the person on the higher, but use it as a tool to get a plea bargain to a lesser offense.
Mr. Chair, I cannot disagree with you. We've seen that in practice, and that's one of the concerns I have with Measure 11, because it basically does shift the balance for negotiations, I think, as a prosecutor to the wrong side, or too great to the state. Because we have seen, actually, in Multnomah County specifically, where youth who have charged with Measure 11 offenses will, in fact, opt for a lesser sentence and also waive their right to appeal and will be placed into the adult correction system, knowing that they are going to serve a shorter period of time than what they would be exposed to with a Measure 11 sentence.
Even if they might have been.
Brown.
Representative Lowe has a dash A13 amendments, which in addition to including the dash A14 amendments, which is the FDF amendments regarding the abuse reporting statute, eliminates the affirmative defense for the crime of criminal non-secure. Why was that not included in the minority report? Simply because of...
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, the reason it was included is at the time that we were looking at this and having the short period of time to file a minority report, what I wanted to make certain is that a parent in the lesser situations where not to belittle the injury that could occur to a child, but we thought through my discussions with a couple other people, that that would be one level that you could allow for the parents to be able to exercise their religious practice without having the state in a position of questioning each and everything that they did. I understand, and reflecting on that, I do believe there needs to be some modification there. But at the time that we're doing it, we're trying to piece something together that we thought that would be amenable on the floor of the House.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Jeff Lowe.
Thank you.
Committee, we're going to go a little longer, as you anticipate, but I'm going to ask, though, I'm going to call up six more witnesses against and ask if you could just each take a couple minutes. You've all been very patient. Then we'll go back to witnesses that were in favor of the bill, and we'll conclude with Ingrid Swenson, who's listed as neutral. So, Gwendolyn Whitmore, Connie Eldridge, and I can't read your last name, and Nikki Hudson.
Connie was
there, yeah. Oh, excuse me, Connie was, excuse me. So I'll pick Karen Davis. I guess I have three. If you could identify yourself, please begin.
Senator Bryant and committee, my name is Nikki Hudson. I live in Boring, Oregon. I have been teaching math in high school for the last 16 years, and I was selected as a recent Oregon Teacher of the Year in
1998. Congratulations.
I've had the privilege of representing Oregon at many educational events across the nation and across our state over the last year. I have observed a common theme throughout all discussions centered on the education of young people. The disturbing thing is that children today seem emotionally and spiritually disconnected from their communities, their families, and from each other. The natural question that comes up at these conferences among teachers especially, but parents and community members, is how can we help children define who they are and how they can healthily function in a very diverse society? Across the board, educators agree that the answer is not based on setting some sort of higher standard of behavior in sort of an impersonal, clinical way. The answer that seems to come forward is that the only way to help kids is to make one-on-one connections with them as they deal with their reactions and their feelings, and they proceed to choose their responding actions to the events of the world around them. So the one question that keeps coming to my mind in regard to this bill is, why would we want to limit the freedom of parents that choose to raise their children to turn away from violence and prejudice and turn first to God in the face of any crisis? I was raised to turn to God first for guidance, not just in illness situations, but in moral dilemmas. And one of the things that is very significant in my life is that I was often faced with asking the hard questions and not reacting but positively acting. And I see this as something in my students' eyes every day, is how can I help them know what is a good choice? In particular, growing up, I did have the healings where I prayed first and later was led to do the appropriate thing. In particular, I had a healing when I was 12. Clearly, it appeared I had some sort of reaction to toxins when I was helping my uncle do some weeding, fertilizing, if you will. And basically, through the choice of my own, I chose spiritual prayer and had great success with that. I grew up learning that by praying first in crisis, I found the most effective way to face each challenge. In some cases, I experienced quick spiritual healing, and in other cases, I didn't. But I was always led to do the right step. So I just want to ask you, don't we need more young people that are inspired to prayerfully turn to God first for decisions and not to reactive, violent behavior? To me, I was sort of thinking, I do teach calculus, and I was often feeling that the art of healing is sort of like the study of calculus. Just because someone fails a calculus test, it does not mean that there is something incorrect about the principle of the mathematics involved. And healers, whether by spiritual or medical means, have all had success and failures. Why would we want to limit a responsible parent's choice or a responsible child's choice? Why would we want to limit a young person's opportunity to learn to rely on God first? Thank you very much.
I'm Gwendolyn Whitmore. I am an English teacher at Denton High School in Portland, Oregon, and I've taught there for a number of years, 13 or 14. I was counting up at the kitchen sink last night, thinking, how long have I even been there? So I've been there quite a while. I've been teaching in Portland and in Oregon for 15 years next year altogether. Chairman Bryant and members of the committee.
Do we have a copy of the test?
Yes, right here. You don't, but you will have it. Okay.
And Gwendolyn, we'll have your written testimony. If you could possibly just summarize it, that would be the best.
All right.
Thank you.
I have followed the deliberations of this body in relation to the question now before it with very great interest. Thank you to each of you for your thoughtful consideration of the issues. It seems to me that it is going to take divine wisdom for each one of you to know what to do in a way which will defend the integrity of the state's interest in protecting children while yet delicately balancing the right of parents to make decisions concerning their children. I am not a lifelong Christian scientist, but came into the study of this religion in my teenage years. My grandfather and father were both Protestant clergymen, and I count at least six men of the cloth as relatives, and because of this, I have close and affectionate ties with the church. I am a high school English teacher at Benson High School in Portland. My husband is a first grade teacher at Oregon Episcopal School, and we have two children. Our youngest is in the elementary school period, and our eldest is a freshman at Robert Donald Clark Honors College of the University of Oregon. Christian Science is the usual health care choice of our family because it is so effective. Fevers, a back problem, skin eruptions, some dental needs, severe pain, these are a few of the sicknesses and diseases which have been healed through the application of Christian Science in our experience. As a child, I suffered more than once from painful earaches, and I remember the abandonment I felt when medical treatment I received did not relieve me as had been hoped. A couple of years ago, our eldest suffered terrible ear pain after prolonged swimming in Central Oregon, and we prayed about this as taught in Christian Science. The pain vanished with the kind of prayer taught by Christian Science, and her hearing, which had been lost in one ear, was quickly restored. When our youngest was 3 years old, she suffered a broken ankle in a bunk bed mishap at a friend's house. My husband and I quickly assessed the situation and took her to the local hospital where she had emergency surgery to set the bone. We continued to apply Christian Science prayer to the case both in the hospital and during the brief number of weeks following as the bone knit. A Christian Science practitioner worked closely with us during this period in the hospital and throughout the following days and made frequent visits to our child. I would mention that our doctor noted that the healing took place far more quickly than had been expected and that he was exceedingly pleased with the nature and excellence of the healing. During this healing period, no medications were needed to allay pain and inflammation because the child was comfortable and alert, as carefully observed by the doctor involved. During the delivery of both children, our attending physicians asked us if various drugs typically given to babies should be administered. Both doctors were very respectful of the serious responsibility with which we entered into health care decisions for the girls. And when we decided against medications and in favor of Christian Science treatment, the doctors involved were comfortable. As tiny infants, both girls were healed overnight of jaundice, and for this and other healthy adjustments, our physicians openly acknowledged that perfect health had been established for the babies. I would mention that each attending doctor remarked at the quick and smooth deliveries of the babies, and one used that perhaps she should have a Christian Science practitioner working with her on all of her deliveries. Her respect for the results was genuine. We make every decision as deeply and conscientiously as we can. My husband and I have both taken instruction in the methodology of Christian Science Healing and find this kind of prayer to be a practical choice for us. I would add that my husband is a fourth-generation Christian Scientist and that in the collective memory of his family stands a record of countless healings through applying Christian Science, some of which are truly remarkable. We are free to make the best health care decision for us. Our branch church teaches that members are responsible for their own decisions and that no member is to be criticizing others for their choices. I think that God can heal anyone. My responsibility is to evaluate every health care need in relation to my present developed spirituality. My husband and I do this freshly each time when either child is sick, which thankfully is infrequent. In the school setting where I work, I notice that many students are suffering because they lack the kind of spiritual nurture which my children receive. In ways that are legal and humanitarian, I offer this support to my truly wonderful high schoolers, a viewpoint which is both affectionate and intelligent. I seek to embrace each child with respect, dignity, and care, and it helps. The problems kids are dealing with today are staggering. Dysfunctional relationships, substance abuse, early pregnancy, emotional instability, suicide, incredible anger. We've heard it all. I can tell you that many youngsters in our society are hurting. House Bill 2494, as I understand it with its amendments, would seek to criminalize the manner with which we have brought up our eldest and are bringing up our youngest, a method which stands in stark contrast to the care many children are getting. Our children are happy, healthy, very creative, and hardworking young people who do very well in school, who participate in a full round of community activities, who get along with their parents, who enjoy the company of others while yet resisting the lure of substance abuse and promiscuity. They are polite and kind and very funny and yet very independent. Is it possible that my husband and I will become criminals for parenting in this manner and with these results? Surely the members of this body will choose to protect the lively and effective practice which we have entered into with deliberate care and, may I add, with thoughtful awareness of societal expectations. Surely there is a way to balance the state's desire to protect children while yet allowing space for responsible Christian Science parents to continue working at spiritual healing. It would be in the interest of children and adults in our state to have this method of healing protected in every way possible. This kind of healing, when entered into intelligently, we need to emphasize that, will support children in a way which will make Oregonians very glad indeed.
Chair.
Yes.
I know you're trying to move on. I just have a question. This is your testimony. Can't see a thing out of line. Is there anything in the law that's before the bill before us that would prevent her from doing what she's done?
Only if it came to the point where it was life-threatening, and at that point did not choose to use standard care or standard medical practice, then there would be exposure.
Because what she's doing is, you know, I admire it.
I'm not a lawyer, and I don't claim to understand this bill very well. I'm up to speed. But what I have been told is that should certain portions of this bill pass, if my child is sick, I am required by law to report this to in some way to have medical intervention right at the get-go, so that everyone can watch and see that if things are progressing nicely. Now, maybe I've misunderstood the bill, but my understanding is that I am flirting with criminal activity to rely on spiritual healing if there is a change, if there isn't some kind of a balance to give us a little bit of space here to work with this methodology that we find effective and loving.
Our staff could respond to that.
Well, my comment was more relating to the existence of the current law rather than what was passed in the minority report, which was apparently a compromise attempt that made a distinction between someone who's 18 years old than someone who is at least 15 years of age. But I don't think the intent is to turn someone in for the practices that were just described. But it's probably not very well worded.
It shouldn't happen, right?
Yeah.
Mr. Bemis, I'm glad you are an attorney.
I am, yes.
I'm sure you're familiar with the judge when he says you have 3 minutes to close. And you have given us, and I briefly scanned it, 8 pages of testimony that we will read. But would you mind just summarizing in a brief form what you
I appreciate the warning, and I will not read my statement. I think there's three things that have come up today that I think are important to keep in mind as you're deliberating. And I, too, would like to share my appreciation for the quality of thought that has gone on, as very evidenced by the committee's activity today. One is that all spiritual treatment is the same. It's not. And let's not lump it all into the same category. Two, that somehow the churches or parents are compelling or forcing their kids to rely on spiritual treatment. That's not true. It may be in certain instances, but at least in my experience and the church members that I associate with as a Christian Scientist, I've never evidenced that to be the case. And three, that somehow spiritual treatment is doing nothing. Nothing could be further from the truth. It is a very effective means of curing very difficult situations. And my testimony refers to two situations in particular, one in which I broke my arm and relied on spiritual treatment very effectively, very quickly, and very immediately. And it was my choice. I was a 12-year-old at the time. And my immediate reaction was to rely on prayer to deal with that situation. And by the time less than a week had passed, I was able to go on an activity to camp and utilize that arm without limitation. The other situation, which you might find of interest, is a situation where I had a tumor growing in my jaw, and we had relied on spiritual prayer to treat the situation for several months. It was very disturbing. It wasn't painful, but it was a situation where we had really delved in deeply to spiritual treatment. And after some very extensive discussions about the appropriate thing to do, my parents gave me a choice. They said, what would you like to do? What is your comfort level with where we go from here? And we talked through those options, and we chose to seek medical care in that situation. I had it surgically removed. That was before the broken arm. And I, ever since then, that's the only time I've ever seen a hospital, been in a hospital, relied on any type of medication for any physical condition. And I've had a number of very remarkable healings since then. My concern, I don't need to repeat what's already been said, but in response to the chairman's comment about the current law and the question raised by Senator Duncan about our ability to practice our law under the present law or under the amendments, I have a concern with that, because if you look at the proposed amendments withdrawing the recognition of spiritual treatment in the juvenile code and the abuse reporting provisions, and if you look at the proposed modifications to the criminal mistreatment laws, those are all premised upon a definition that medical care is the only legitimate care. If you remove the recognition of spiritual treatment, it creates a presumption, an automatic mandate, that you provide medical care. And the homicide stuff, that I'm not concerned with that. I don't expect to face that. What concerns me is the day-to-day reality of the criminal mistreatment laws and the abuse laws being used to force me to do something that I don't feel is as effective as reliance on prayer. And so I would urge extreme caution in skipping around those areas and making sure we develop a good balance allowing and providing for our ability to practice, and at the same time, protecting the health of children. We all share that interest. I don't think there's anybody here that doesn't feel the state has a compelling need to protect the interest in health of children. We should be given some flexibility to utilize what we feel is effective and have demonstrated to be effective over the years. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Brown.
Just a question along those lines, and I guess I would just tell you, I don't feel comfortable with the statute as it is in terms of
I just see the abuse of pointing statute as being very effective for identifying those kids who aren't getting some of the things they need. And so do you see that there's some room for balance between the DASH 13? I don't know if you've seen the DASH 13 amendments. Do you think there's room? Okay.
I believe there's definite room for somehow enhancing the reporting obligations or dealing with that issue. I think something needs to be done to deal with the situation in Oregon City. That's a tragedy to me. But we can't deal with that over broadly. That compelling interest needs to be met with a narrowly tailored, responsible approach.
Okay. Thank you.
Chairman,
Davis, you made a comment that all spiritual healing is not the same. If I'm correct.
Correct.
Doesn't the legislature have to consider the constitutionality of all spiritual healing?
I don't think so. I think that you have a compelling interest to protect the interests of in health of children. If a particular treatment is effective, and I think that's what we need to look to is the result, not the means. If the result of a certain method of spiritual treatment is effective, that your compelling interest is satisfied. If a particular method of spiritual treatment is not effective, then your compelling interest has the right to step in and monitor that situation and deal with that situation.
I'm going to cut off the questions because I told the committee we're going to be wrapping it by 6. You're free to ask that question afterward, then, Mr. Taylor. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
I'd invite Wendy Borg. And
she's here already.
Did she catch fire already?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I thought she did. It's only been 3 hours. And I'm Dr. Lace. Do I have that correct? Okay. It looks like Sings K. Clace. All right. All right. We have some written testimony from him. Doug Vandegreen, you'd come forward. And Karen Davis and Carl Grossman.
Mr. Chairman, good question. Are any of these representing the followers of Christ?
Not even so far. So I don't think any of the followers of Christ are here. Is that correct? Is anyone here from the followers of Christ? I don't think anyone is.
No one is here.
Good afternoon. If you could identify yourself and begin, please.
Yeah, thank you, Senator O'Brien and members of the committee. My name is Doug Vandegreen, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Western Center for Law and Religious Freedom. We're a public interest law firm here in Oregon. I've also practiced law here, including 10 years of criminal defense in the county of Marion County. We, in our public interest law firm, especially emphasize First Amendment rights, and within that, particularly focus on religious freedom rights. I am here in favor of this bill. However, it's difficult to say exactly where you are there. I would commend to this committee those provisions that are contained in Amendment Dash 10. I believe those amendments particularly strike a balance that we're actually extremely concerned with. As I think is obvious to this committee, the two interests that are pushing against each other here are the interests of parents' rights, or we would probably term it here religious freedom, and also the life of children. Let me just very briefly suggest a framework for this legislature and this committee to follow when dealing with these things. We also expressed these at the House Committee, and I think some of our concerns were put into Dash 10 that we think are very important. To the extent that the criminal penalties are large, we would encourage the legislature not to repeal the religious exemption. And that's for some of the reasons that you've already stated. I'm not going to be too redundant about it, but it's this. Essentially, a criminal penalty is after the fact, not before the fact. We tend to believe that when you are considering after the fact penalties, you should more be in favor of the religious liberty rights, because you're not doing anything constructive then. You're simply being punitive. To some extent, you're being constructive, but for the most part, you're being punitive. On the other hand, when you have religious exemptions that reduce the amount that people can report, or reduce the ability of the state to take juvenile jurisdictions, or things like that, those things are designed to be constructive, not responses after the fact. To that extent, we would urge this committee and the legislature to remove the religious exemptions so that the state can do its job, and that is to protect life at the minimum extent. Now, if the welfare of the child is not such a big deal, there's no life-threatening problems here, we would tend to argue that the state should at that point defer in preference to the parents. To the extent that it is life-threatening, then we believe that government should say, we've got a job to do, and we will do it. Obviously, these are difficult lines to draw, but we would not recommend that with regard to the major crimes, the religious exemption be repealed. One of the things I want to specifically address is this. So far, testimony has suggested that prosecutors out there will all be very good about construing what it is that they can and cannot prosecute. I've practiced criminal defense here for 10 years. I would beg to differ. I have seen in my own personal case and others that prosecutors will, in fact, overcharge and overtry. If we all agree that murder just shouldn't be applied in a case like this, then let's not remove the exemption. Keep the shield. There's no need to remove it. I would particularly commend to you the provision in the Dash 10 amendments that suggests this. As to some of those middle crimes, Dash 10 amendments suggest that the defendant can avail him or herself of those defenses if they first report to the health department. Now, I did hear some concerns from the health department about possible liability problems there, but I think in this case, that presents a very innovative and creative solution to be proactive. To me, it's a win-win scenario. If you do, in fact, report, then the government can do its job. And if those parents are sincere, they can still choose to treat their child as they will. One other thought. I know people. In fact, I have one in my office who does practice in a way that she has different medical philosophies about things. I am firmly convinced that with respect to some people, including the person I think Senator Duncan you referred to as coming into your office, with regard to some people who are very much a little bit tentative about being in a particular religion, whatever it is, Christian Science, followers of Christ, whatever it is, that tend to look at this, you're going to have some people in those religions who are a little bit tentative, who refuse to make the decision themselves for their children because they think they then are choosing against their child's welfare, even though the majority of society would say otherwise, or they don't want to damn their child's soul to hell. Sometimes, and I think it's more often than we might think, they look at the state making the decision as their way out. Maybe they don't even consciously do it. But it is there. And in fact, I had an extensive discussion with this person in my office about that, about what she would do in certain situations. And that's exactly what it came down to. So on the one hand, I'm going to vigorously suggest that we not remove the shield as to those major crimes, because it does us no good to put these people who were doing their best to save their child's body and soul, it does no good to impose a Measure 11 sentence on them. On the other hand, the state must do its job. So to the extent that it's a major crime, keep the shield in place. To the extent that the child's life is threatened, keep the shield in place. To the extent that neither of those are the case, that it's a lower crime, or that it's just a reporting statute, or that it's not the life that we're talking about, but maybe, you know, a cold or something like that, respect the parent's rights. That's what we see as the balance that should be struck here, and I hope the committee can do that.
I think one of the reasons why we're here today, at least my sense of this, is that at least from the prosecutor's standpoint in Clackamas County, the law as it is not consistent and is confusing to parents in the community. And obviously, we'll, you know, lawyers disagree about a lot of things, and certainly other folks would have a different interpretation. But to the sense that, at least in the community, there's some confusion about when the law is applied. Don't you think we have a duty to at least clarify it and make it somewhat consistent?
Yep, absolutely. I always advocate clarity.
Good afternoon, if you could identify yourself.
Good evening.
Yeah,
good evening.
Good evening. My name is Karen Davis, and I am also one of the attorneys in the house, although I am in-house counsel, and my specialty is employment law. I am not an expert in criminal law. However, I was asked to look specifically at the amendments to 419B, .005 and .100. And just to give you a little bit of background, I was raised as a Christian Scientist, one of six kids, and we're a very active, sports-oriented family and found Christian Science to be absolutely an effective method of health care for us. You notice I said health care. When we talk about health care, now a lot of people assume that means only medical care, but realize there are several different ways to get to the goal of health care. And bottom line, these amendments turn away from looking at the result. They turn away from looking at the desired result of healthy kids and instead mandate one particular method of health care, which is medical care. So if I could ask you, really any of these amendments you have in front of you, but probably the dash 12 ones are easiest to look at. If you take a look at page 6, and if you look at the suggested amendment, you'll notice that it starts out by defining abuse. If you look sort of at the bottom of that page there on page 6 of the dash 12, negligent treatment includes failure to provide adequate food, clothing, shelter, or medical care. So it starts out by saying it's got to be medical care. But then the language that is proposed to be deleted clarifies that to say just because you are choosing a different method of health care, if you focus on the result, is the kid healthy, then your choice to rely on spiritual means is okay. So in other words, if you take out that second sentence, what are you left with? You're required to provide medical care. So even if, let's say you have a Christian Science kid on the one hand and you've got a non-Christian Science kid on the other hand, let's say they both have earaches. If the Christian Science kid recovers faster, the parents have still committed abuse under these proposed amendments because it wasn't medical care. It was health care. Remember, health care is that umbrella, but it wasn't medical care. And so that's my concern with this amendment here, is that it focuses on the method of health care instead of keeping your eye on the goal, which is healthy kids.
Chairman?
Yes, Senator.
Don't you consider the healing that you do to be a form of medical care?
It's a form of, I would say, health care. When I talk about medicine, I'm imagining, I don't know, putting a drug into my vein or taking a pill. And I think for most people, when they imagine medical care, it means going to the doctor, going to a hospital. And that is one effective means, absolutely, of health care. However, I would submit that there are alternatives and others that have worked for people.
I assume under that amendment, if a family was an Asian family and treating their child through Eastern medicine, acupuncture, whatever, that the abuse reporting would not apply, if there would be no exemption for that particular family because it's not what we would read as medical care.
Potentially, the concern would be, and all I'm saying is focus on the bottom line, focus on the result. Is the kid getting well at least as fast or faster than somebody else in medical care? And if this defines abuse as a failure to provide medical care and doesn't go on with any kind of clarification of that, then the kid who gets well, even if they get well faster using that alternative method, the parents have still committed abuse. So to continue with your thoughts, maybe some more inclusive language needs to be added there in that clarifying language, which might address your concerns about what about the Asian parent who wants to practice some form of alternative Asian healing. That I don't know. All I do know is that by removing that second sentence, you've mandated one particular method instead of focusing on your goal, which is healthy kids. I don't want to repeat what's in my written testimony, but if I could just ask you to turn to the second page of my written testimony. I gave some thought to what do we really mean when we're talking about health care here. And just kind of brainstorming, coming up with a list there, regardless of whether you choose medicine or if you choose, it's on page 2 of my written testimony, regardless of whether you choose medicine or whether you choose prayer, don't we all want to prevent infection? We want to prevent disease. And going on through here, we want to eliminate pain, stop fear or depression, and promote wellness. I think members of the medical and religious communities would agree, isn't that what health care really is? And so if we keep our eyes focused on what's our goal, what is good health care, then whatever method is used to accomplish those goals, I don't think the government should be stepping in and mandating one particular method. Thank you. Those are all my comments.
Thank you. Mr. Grossman.
Chairman Bryant, members of the committee. My name is Carl Grossman, and I live in Clackamas County, work in Portland as the president of a good-sized construction company. I grew up in a medical family. My father is a doctor. I have a brother that's a doctor, and a brother-in-law that's a doctor, and a niece that's a doctor, and a nephew that's a doctor. There's a lot of doctors in my family. And I was introduced to you, but I also know about the healing power of Christian Science prayer.
We have some interesting family dinners.
You know what? We actually do. There's some very lively discussions. I was introduced to the concept of Christian Science and ultimately the practice of it by my wife, who is a third-generation Christian Scientist. And I have seen firsthand many healings of both mild and serious physical conditions by the application of prayer, often with the support of a Christian Science practitioner. But today I'd like you to focus on the track record of the other choice, mainstream medicine as it's practiced today. I'm very familiar with it. Just last week on the front page of the Oregonian was an article that told of tens of thousands of people dying each year as a result of mistakes by the medical profession. In April of last year, the Journal of the American Medical Association stated that 2 million people are infected in hospitals each year and that 90,000 of them die from these infections. To bring that home to Oregon, which has 1.2% of the U.S. population, our share of that would be 1,200 people that would die, more than 3 people every single day from situations that occurred while they were under the care of mainstream medicine. And these issues go on and on. They're documented by the AMA, by the New York Times, the LA Times, the Boston Globe. But if a doctor makes a mistake and someone dies, he or she does not come under the penalty regulations of Measure 11, which would impose a minimum sentence of 6 years in prison. A doctor who loses a patient is reviewed by his or her peers and may be sanctioned. But never that I know have they been tried as criminals or sentenced to those kinds of penalties. All we're asking is that we're able to conduct our lives and follow our religious beliefs on a level playing field that's fair for everybody. Should there be some way to regulate the high number of deaths that have occurred with a small sect in Oregon City? Yes, I believe very strongly that there should be. I support increased vigilance and enforcement and better methods of reporting medical emergencies under the existing guidelines. But the bill now before you, it is not the answer. And I urge you to vote no on this bill. And please, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. And in closing, I'd like to tell you of an effective Christian Science healing in my own life. In 1991, my wife was pregnant, her first trimester of that pregnancy, and she got a severe case of chickenpox. And we went to the best medical experts in the country who recommended terminating that pregnancy, unequivocally. All the doctors we consulted recommended terminating that pregnancy. We relied instead on Christian Science care and the prayerful support of a Christian Science practitioner. And my son Skyler was born in a hospital instead of at home like my other son, as a concession to my brother, the doctor, who was very worried about serious birth defects or worse. The delivery went without serious birth defects, or went without medication and without incident, and Skyler scored a perfect 10 on the APGAR scale, which is the measure of fetal development and physical completeness in newborns. Some could say that happened as a matter of chance, but the indisputable reality is that if we had listened to the doctors, I wouldn't have my son Skyler today. And I am very grateful that we had a choice to rely on Christian Science instead of the recommendations of the medical profession. Thank you very much.
Questions, Senator Hawkins.
Since Wu-Tang beat your dinners, I'm curious what your brother says.
You know, even more importantly, my father was a psychiatrist. And he believed very strongly in the benefit of prayer to the effect of healing on the human experience. Really, very strongly. And my brother Roy, he's kind of a funny guy. He had a walk-in, he's an emergency room medical practitioner. And he said, you know, Carl, just keep your eye on the newspapers. Whatever they're touting in medicine today, it'll be just the opposite if you're patient. If you just wait long enough, they'll come up with just the opposite theory because things are changing all the time.
Other questions? Thank you for your testimony. We have one last witness, and Elizabeth Grasser, as she comes forward, if you have written testimony, the committee would really appreciate it, and we'll give you about 30 seconds, but I've already exceeded the patience of my committee by probably 45 minutes of what I told them we would do today. So thank you. The others are here and have shown great interest, and so we hope you've found this to be beneficial and how democracy works. And what the chair has decided to do is put together a little work group to take a look at this, and members of the Christian Science religion will be invited to participate in that, and we'll see what that comes up with. So I've asked Senator Courtney to work on that for me, and if another senator would like to be involved in it, you're certainly welcome to do that. But with that, we are adjourned.
I have one here, talk about it here.